At this point, as it starts to approach and come behind that freeway sign, and I already been instructed not to hit anybody but Kennedy because they didn't want Jackie getting hurt or anybody else, I'm fixing to lose my fill of fire. And at this point, either I shoot or I can put it in a suitcase and leave, one or the other. I took the shot. I fired one shot only.
And where were you aiming?
Well, I was aiming for his right eye, which to me is the left side of his head looking head on. But for him, it would be his right eye. And once I pull the trigger, I'm right in on it, and it's almost like looking 6 feet away through the scope. As I squeezed, take off my round, his head moved forward, I missed, and I coming right along the temple, just right behind the eye.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome back to Alive, not the BCFM Politics Show, Friday the 4th of August, 2023. And we're 5 minutes late, I'm afraid. Just setting the clocks right and putting the coffee on, which is no excuse whatsoever. Sorry, folks. On the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Available free from all good app stores, but anything please but Google. That is the Google Play Store. Delete it somehow. I don't know, whatever it is, get rid of it and use anything but them. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, the puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling the vote winners. And now, of course, trying to cancel Putin too. Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment drones want us slaves to their machines. And we've got a wife-murdering king, haven't we, too. So, anyway, this is what the BBC might sound like if I'd been allowed to carry on there. But maybe you can see quite clearly now why they decided not to let me carry on. Anyway, helping navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, joining us from Herefordshire. Also in the studio, we've got Tony Groner and Tyler Overall. They are here at the People's Republic Arts Centre tomorrow showing their film. Also in part two, or maybe just before part two, we've got on the line Don DeBar, who's just come back from China. He's a New York reporter on Pacifica Radio, who's been looking into the plight of the Uyghur Muslims in China. Now, what's really happening? Because there's so much propaganda around that story. Don's just got back from going over there, so it'd be interesting to see what he's got to say about that, and also whether or not Donald Trump is going to be running for president or end up behind bars. So, Iranian and Russian news cancelled in the UK, first by the telecoms cartels and then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off puny little Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So, first of all, to our guests, Tony, you've joined us at quite short notice. I spoke to you earlier this week, but can you just tell us a bit about your background and why you decided to make this film?
So I'm a film student in Bristol, and I wanted to make this documentary about Kill the Bill, like, since I've seen the videos online when it happened in March 2021. It was shocking. And then I met Tyler at a party, and we were just like, let's do it, because Tyler was, like, due to go to court in, like, 3 weeks, and we just did it.
Okay, so you just made the film, just like that. What made you decide you wanted to do film studies then?
I kind of always wanted to make films, and it's like a really good medium to talk about everything and like to educate people. And yeah, to be fair, my mom is also working in film. I guess that was a reason as well.
Yeah, okay, so when you say you were shocked, what shows shocked you about what happened with the Kill the Bill demonstrations? Because, I mean, it went all the way around the world. What most people saw in other parts of the world was burning police vans.
It was not just burning police vans, because I had already, like, contacts in Bristol, and I saw the videos they posted, and it was shocking to see the police, how brutal they were, how aggressive, like, just like women and other people just got beaten up. And I cried when I've seen those videos. I was not there because I was in Germany back then, but yeah, it's like a human right to protest and defending your human right, and then get treated like this. That's horrible.
I suppose the police will say, well, look, you know, actually what we're doing is we're bringing in a new law which is going to curtail the right to protest. So yeah. It's bound to be a bit of a clash.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it's interesting you're from Germany. What made you decide to come to Bristol to study?
I was here to do an au pair to improve English. And then I just found it really interesting, like, Bristol is a hub for every kind of person and creativity and loads of things are going on. Yeah, that made me... And then COVID, Berlin was quite depressing, which is not Berlin's fault, but I just started to apply to study here.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about, you met Tyler here. Tyler, do you want to chip in here?
Yep.
What was your involvement in the... Well, they called it a riot, didn't they? But it wasn't quite really a riot.
I wouldn't actually personally call it a riot, just from my experiences on the day. I wouldn't call it a riot. I mean, like, there were very, like, different things that went on, and some of them were a bit like, whoa, you know, with, like, the burning the police car and things like that. They were like, you know... But, I mean, in terms of it, like, throughout the day, like, in my memory and, like, how I remember how that day was, it was just, like, a normal day. I know it was COVID, so, like, it wasn't quite too normal. But, like, it was a day where, like, the streets were filled with people. There wasn't really people wearing face masks. Like, it was just, like, the streets were empty. There was nothing going on in Bristol. And then it just went to being, like... I don't know, a nice hot summer's day in Bristol where, you know, the whole city is just completely active, you know what I mean?
Okay, so what was really motivated you to come down and get involved in this demonstration?
So my family are horse-drawn travellers. Some, my nan is anyway. My mum used to, like, get us to live on sites when we were young. So we'd live on, like, on the Piord and stuff. And these are, like, just, like, traveller sites in, like, Wales and areas like that. But my mum's kind of, like, always kind of just, like, gone to, like, her travelling routes kind of thing. So...
Well, there's, like, not actually a lot of travellers left, are there? I think, really, since World War II. I mean, if you... I'm just taking a step back from all of this.
Yeah.
And there used to be this massive itinerant labour force out there that would, at certain times of the year... For example, harvest seasons, these sorts of things,
yeah,
would suddenly turn up and do loads of work. And then, I mean, that's the thing, that's the nature of the work market. Sometimes lots of people are needed. And now everybody seems to be moaning and complaining. There's not enough Eastern Europeans to pick the fruit. Actually, if you go back 40, 50, 60 years, there were plenty, and there were people who lived here in the UK. So what's your explanation of the way that the numbers of travellers have slowly gone down of all sorts?
I just mean, like, it will be just from the government, really. I mean, just, like, on their complete tackle on, they don't really want people living roadside. They don't want you not paying taxes and stuff like that.
Why not?
Oh, I mean...
Taxes, you've just hit the... You've actually beaten me with the answer to the question there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for example, if you're a boater... particularly not here in Bristol, because they've been hitting people with massive mooring fee increases. But say, for example, you're cruising, you know, you're talking about maybe £3,000 or £4,000 for a rather tatty boat, £600 I think it is for the year.
Yeah,
you know, which is £50 a month or something, and you can survive like that,
yeah,
actually.
Of course.
Whereas if you're trying to rent nowadays, it's almost impossible, isn't it?
Yeah. Man, yeah, absolutely. I was paying £750 a month to live in a bedroom that didn't have a window before I went to jail.
So you ended up going to jail. Just take us through the trial and the sentence.
So I never made it to trial. I was offered late, like it was like May. I was offered like mid-May, end of May. It was like the 19th of May or something like that, where I was actually offered from the charge because I was charged with riot. They dropped the charge instead of me going to trial for riot. They dropped it down so I could take a guilty plea for violent disorder, so where they could get a definite conviction, but it wasn't me going to jail for like 7.5 years.
So the sentence is over.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's good, because it means we can talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, actually, during an active case,
I mean,
you know, you have to be a bit careful.
Actually over, I mean,
well, no, I mean, it's, if you've been sentenced, we can talk quite freely about it.
I mean, yeah.
It's just while the trial's going on. You've got to be a bit, you've got to be very careful and very balanced. So I can ask you a little bit more about it. This whole idea of plea bargaining, how did you feel when they said, offered you, what they've done is they've said to you, we're going to charge you with this very extreme, version of events, which you may actually potentially have got off of, but they've come to you and it's essentially what the Americans call a plea bargain, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you react when they told you that?
So, I mean, like, I've never been involved in anything like this before. So for me, I was kind of like, I didn't know I was going to get arrested. I personally thought that, you know, that protest was just like, okay, it was a day in Bristol where, like, a police car got set on fire and da-da-da, like the Black Lives Matter thing, you know, where the Colston got thrown into the harbour. It's just a day like that, you know, some extreme things happen, but I mean, like, it isn't, like, bizarre, you know what I mean? Because it's not actually, like, a big impact on my life or whatever. But I mean, like, little did I know is that I was going to then be sent to jail for it, you know what I mean? Like, I kicked a riot shield, like, and the police officer was actually assaulting people at the moment in time. So that was just like, it was me, but like, protecting other people in a sense. Like, I wasn't, like, I physically didn't cause him harm. Yeah, I mean, I could have put him in harm, essentially. I mean, if things went bad, but I mean, like,
yeah, I mean, so if you're kicking you're kicking something which is attached to somebody,
yeah,
I mean, that was, I mean, potentially, no, you're shaking your head, Tony.
Well, it was the riot police, like, they are,
I mean, them shields are made, I've
protected, like, you can't
well, I suppose they've got like Tyler polystyrene underwear or something, haven't they? They're wearing, I'm not sure if that quite goes down,
I mean,
to their underwear,
but they are designed specifically to defend from things like that. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, like, the police officer, I'm sure from me kicking that shield, I mean, he might have got a nudge backwards or whatever. He might have been, you know.
And why, but did,
I
mean, you, why, like, did you do it?
Because he was assaulting people.
Now, the whole situation, I don't know how long you were there for, but can you tell us how this developed? Because certainly, I mean, I'll just tell you what I've seen from the footage. I've got some very good footage Bristol 24/7 put up, which was almost the whole day, showed you how things developed. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to watch. I wasn't down there. But, you know, you can see that there's a peaceful protest going on. The police turn up and they decide they want to move everyone away. Now, of course, they didn't have to do that. They could have just let the protest finish, let the people go home. But they decided,
I mean, if the police didn't come out of that police station, we wouldn't have stayed there. Because when the police came out, I wasn't there when it actually, like, erupted. Because I've seen, we went through the footage for hours and hours trying to, like, because we all kind of, like, we all the co-defendants and stuff, well, not all of them, but a majority of them, some of us knew each other and stuff like that from, like, different, like, friends and stuff like that. It was a popular thing. Lots of people got arrested and stuff for it. So, like, we became involved with one another to the point where, like, we were, like, meeting each other up. We were going to, like, each other's houses and stuff, and we were going through footage that we could find online and anything like that. We were getting, like, all of people that we knew and stuff that were there, and it wasn't just us, it was multiple people. So that, like, we were bringing in a lot of people that were bringing in footage, and we were going through it for hours and hours and hours on end, trying to find things to help in support for each individual defendant. So
what was your sentence eventually?
I was charged with riot and
but violent disorder eventually, wasn't it? That's what you said.
So I was charged with riot and something else. It was
violent
something else.
Disorder.
No, but I mean, I was charged with riot, first of all, and I went, like, a year of my life going through, like, oh, I'm going to court soon for riot, and, like, that's a way
different
charge than violent disorder.
That was the time that all this kind of bargaining was going on. So what was the eventual sentence?
Violent disorder. So I got 21 months for violent
and
disorder.
And so did you actually do time in prison?
Yep, I did 7.5 months in jail.
And now we're going to have to say goodbye to you in about 10 minutes, aren't we? Yeah. Because you have to get back. You're on a tag or something now.
7 p.m. curfew. So I've got that. I've been... So with how the sentencing works is I do 7 months and then I do the 7 months in jail, the 4 months on tag, that's the 10, and then I do the year license, so that makes 21 months. So, I mean, like, I didn't just serve 21 months in jail, but I mean, like, say, for instance, now there's an issue with my tag or anything like that, my probation don't like me or anything like that, it could be an instant recall, I go to jail for a year and a half.
Well, what is it, you know, your way you were brought up, it's a little bit different, isn't it? And have you been to sort of primary school, secondary school, that sort of thing? Like,
I mean, I've got ADHD and stuff like that. Just coming from like my kind of background, I was like the only kind of like fair skinned child in school and stuff like that. I had struggles, not only that, with my ADHD and stuff like that. I kind of played up a little bit because of, like, that's just like how my ADHD and stuff like that was. But I mean, like, I went to school up until my first term of year 7 in high school. And then I was home tutored and stuff like that. But then afterwards, I went on to doing college. And then I was okay. Then my ADHD, I seemed to, like, get a little bit of control on it. I mean, it wasn't great. But, I mean, like, it got me through college.
So how old are you?
28.
Okay. And where do you see yourself going in the future?
Well, I want to be a DJ. I mean, that's...
Are you doing that sort of thing now?
Currently, I can't. I mean, like, not many DJs want to do lunchtime on a weekday, so...
He's DJing tomorrow.
I am tomorrow.
tomorrow evening. So, anyway, do you want to say, Tony, something to wrap up? Do you want to say something about what... Because Tyler's got to get cracking.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about what's happening tomorrow here at the People's Republic?
Yeah, tomorrow we screen the film for the very first time, and it's a fundraiser event for all the defendants, for all the prisoners... to raise some money.
So this money, just to add, this money goes to all the defendants throughout their sentencing. So that could just be from, like, prisoners being paid while they're in jail for just the smallest of things, like phone credit, so they can keep in touch with their people and stuff like that throughout their sentencing. It could be just for, like, some jail food isn't nice. So, I mean, like, you can get, like, condiments and, like, you know, like sauces and stuff like that. And in a place like jail, I mean, it means a hell of a lot. I mean,
is that the first time you've been to jail?
First time I've been to jail.
What was the experience like?
I mean, jail's boring. I mean, the idea of it is terrifying, but once you get there and you realise that a lot of these people are in situations like yourself, I mean, I didn't find anybody in there other than my co-defendants themselves in that situation. Like, usually it's for, like, you know, generic crimes like thieving, you know, being, assaultive and stuff like that. I don't know, just, like, drug dealing, whatever. You know, I mean... all sorts of things, driving offences, drinking, drugs, all sorts, you know what I mean? So, I mean, but, like, in the terms of that, I was very, like, isolated from my things. But, I mean, like, in terms of it, jail for me was easy because they are very, like, anti the government and stuff like that. So when I got there, I was quite a popular guy because they used to call me the anarchists when they'd see us walking down the street, me, Tove and Arthur and stuff. We'd just be like walking down the wing and stuff, and people would be like, "Ah, it's the anarchist," you know, in like a friendly way and stuff like that. I mean,
so are you political in your own way?
I mean, not really. I feel like that, like,
would you go and vote, for example?
Yeah, Tories out every time. I mean, I don't care for politics. Well,
we're going to be hearing
about
some Labour activists that think that actually that Labour would be even worse, amazingly. But that's for in a minute. Just remind us, Tony, when this is happening, and because we're at People's Republic of Stokes Croft, which is here in Jamaica Street in Bristol, just halfway along. You can't really miss it. Lots of murals and that sort of thing around. And what time is it tomorrow?
It starts at 3 p.m. The film screening will be at 4:15, and it goes on till 8 p.m. We have bands, DJs, offer prisoner letter writing, and some people will say something. So, yeah, come around.
Yeah, so that's Saturday the 5th of August from 3 p.m. here at People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Tony Groner and Tyler Overall, and the film is called
Wicked and Bad.
The Wicked and Bad. Is it going to be available for people to watch online if they want?
Yes, soon. Not yet, because...
After you've had some screenings. Yeah, good idea.
Exactly.
Okay, Tony and Tyler, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Just listen, maybe you want to stay for a second. Martin, I know you've been patiently waiting in the background in Herefordshire listening to all this. What do you make of these young people's struggle here? You know, they're actually having a bit of a difficult time with the criminal justice system, particularly with this idea of reading the Riot Act to people that have kicked a shield.
Well, I mean, the overreaction by the government to what happened is palpable, isn't it? They deliberately created, it was Priti Patel because she was struggling, you know, she wanted to be prime minister. So she was pushing this stuff forward because they wanted to rally their own Tory grassroots. And of course, young people quite rightly responded to that by saying, if you're going to criminalise protest, we're going to protest. And of course, it wasn't a riot, right? I lived in Brixton through both of the riots in the 1980s.
Exactly.
Real rioting doesn't look like that at all.
Absolutely not.
It's not. It's that real rioting is very dangerous, and you know, you'd be a fool to think of it as you know,
let's get into a little bit of detail here, because I mean there were things like buildings, houses, cars, etc. being set on fire in Brixton, weren't there?
Yes, well, don't forget that you can't control, if you've got a crowd of people, some people are going to do stupid stuff, and that doesn't mean that everybody's responsible.
Exactly.
And the whole concept of riot is deliberately just, it's just a blanket condemnation of everything that happened.
And
we've had people previously on here from who were at the protest, and the disproportion of the sentences is unbelievable. And it's because they make the whole idea is to make an example of people and all the rest of it, and it's to do with the politics of the Tory press and all the rest of it.
Now, I've got in front of me a copy of the
It's just been a travesty, really.
Of the Bristolian from April this year, 2023, with a picture of our four MPs. There's Kerry McCarthy, Darren Jones, Karen Smith and Thankham Debonair. These are the sort of people that folks like Tyler might go to and say, hang on, they're thinking about a really draconian sentence for me for kicking a riot shield. Is there anything you can do? Well, the Bristolian headline here is Faces of Evil, because they point out that all of these MPs have been approached by the campaign and none of them are interested in helping at all. So they have no interest in these miscarriages of justice. I think that's the only way to call them, is where the courts are corrupt. And of course, we've seen in the United States, you know, well, I don't know about how corrupt the courts are, but Donald Trump attempts to, what you've got is the guy who's one of the most likely to win the office of president, and now they're trying to put him in prison. So if the courts can get corrupted, Martin, where do we go from there? Because that could mean more civil unrest, couldn't it?
Well, it could. I mean, of course, in Northern Ireland, they had the Diplock courts and they didn't have juries and all the rest of it. I think, but what's happened here is it's been people have quite rightly wanted to protest. The police themselves, as been said, they came out of the police station armed up, which actually led to a confrontation that wasn't even necessary. And, the police have got to answer the questions. They've got to answer questions about what they did and how what they did added to what was going on. But, of course, underlying all of this is the completely unacceptable idea that you can police protests. And of course, what's going to happen is people are going to carry on protesting despite the law. And, this is a collision course, potentially.
There were quite a lot of journalists.
Picket lines and police, like in the 1980s. You know,
there were quite a lot of journalists actually arrested.
Confrontations over the years.
Martin, there were quite a lot of journalists arrested at that protest, national and local journalists. Bizarre, then, that the local NUJ branch, the vice chair, put out a letter saying implying that actually the real danger was from the protesters, the anarchists, not from the police, to the journalists in Bristol. But this whole idea that the police will actually, I mean, it's very much the same with the poll tax riots, wasn't it? It's actually a police riot. A riot would not have happened without the actions that the police took.
Exactly.
Well, on the poll tax demonstration, I was there, and I'll tell you what happened. People sat down outside Downing Street. They just sat in the road. Most people picked their way behind the people sitting in the road and were heading off towards Trafalgar Square. So there was no danger of any kind. People were just sitting in the road. Most people weren't sitting in the road. They were just walking by. And then the police came out with full riot gear and started whacking people on the ground. And then the whole crowd stopped, turned around, and turned on the police, because the police had just started whacking people over the head with truncheons who were just sitting on the ground.
I mean, it's a very good film. There's a very good film about this called The Battle of Trafalgar by an old mate of mine, Mark Saunders. Terrific film, if you've never seen it, The Battle of Trafalgar, where they show the police riot van actually driving into a crowd to try and start the riot. Anyway, sounds like we've got another police riot going on. Anyway, listen, Tyler's really got to go. He's got his tag, Martin.
Yep.
Thanks ever so much for joining us, you two. We're going to hear now from Crispin Flintoff, who was in here in Nailsy, just near Bristol last week, with his Not the Andrew Marr Show, doing a whole, he's a kind of Corbynista, doing a whole kind of resistance roadshow. He called it Stand Up for Labour. He was doing all these fundraisers during the Corbyn Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party. And guess what? For his trouble, the Labour Party expelled him.
That was the best time of my life, to see all those people engaged and hopeful. It was just an amazing time. And I don't think it will never be forgotten as a moment in history, those crowds. So I was part of that. I was on that wave of that, putting events on and seeing how many people were interested and blown away by this. And then the Brexit issue sort of came in, and I knew it was the wrong policy to think you could sort of sit on the fence and try and have a second referendum. And then losing that election in 2019, I thought it was kind of inevitable. But what happened then with the COVID and the lockdown, plus Jeremy Corbyn no longer being leader and Starmer coming in, has been hell for all those people that we just talked about who were going out to those events.
What happened to you exactly? Can you just take us through what happened to you? Because you're no longer a member of the party, are you?
No, I got suspended for... I mean, just ridiculous. I mean, there's so many people who've been suspended for ridiculous reasons. I mean, mine is pretty ridiculous. I mean, it is remarkably ridiculous. I was the secretary of my local Labour Party, and the chair wanted to, well, he resigned. And the people in the executive said, we need to have a letter from him to circulate to members about why he's resigned. So I asked the former chair to write a letter, and he sent it to me, and I just circulated it to all the members. In the letter, in one of the paragraphs, he wrote something about anti-Semitism being conflated with anti-Zionism. That was it. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a letter of suspension from the Labour Party for circulating material, for racist material, effectively, as if it was something I'd written that was kind of racist, which I obviously hadn't written it. I didn't even really read it. I just circulated it. So they suspended me, and then on my show, I had a person come on who exposed someone who works for the Labour Party as having a mortgage company that they are a director of at the same time as they are a member, a paid official of the Labour Party. And they showed a company's house screenshot of that company with an address on it, which was the business address. The Labour Party sent me an expulsion letter for harassment of a member of staff and for putting their home address out to everyone. I didn't have any idea that he'd put his home address as his business address on this company. And also it wasn't my feature. It was someone else's. So they expelled me for a feature that was included on Not the Andrew Marr Show. They also sent very threatening letters from lawyers saying that I'd have to pay massive damages for this. They harassed YouTube to pull it down off YouTube. It's still I've still got some kind of like a yellow card from YouTube, even though I've appealed against it. I had to employ a lawyer to refute these to answer back these legal challenge, these legal threats from Labour, and they did that very effectively. And Labour didn't have anything to say after that. They were really trying to scare me. And I've had the same thing from another law firm about a feature I did on bullying in the Labour Party. And some, a big law firm, I think it's the Queen's Law, the former Queen's Law Firm, wrote to me on the morning of the broadcast saying, if you put this out, we'll do this and we'll do that. But the only problem for them is I don't have any assets. I don't own a house or even a car. I don't think they could really get me for much. And I'm sort of, once you've been threatened a couple of times, you sort of just, it doesn't bother you as much, really. But yeah, the Labour Party's like a load of gangsters, as far as I'm concerned. The way they behave, they just get rid of whoever they like on any base for any reason. And there's no justice. I mean, it's written into the Labour Party rule book that natural justice is not part of these rules. I mean, you can't get more blatant.
Crispin Flintoff there from Not the Andrew Marr Show. Crispin Flintoff there from Not the Andrew Marr Show. And Martin, what do you make of what he's saying? Because he's pretty damning about the Labour Party, isn't he?
Well, I mean, we can see what the direction of travel is. Neil Lawson, who is the chair of Compass. Compass is a cross-party organisation that campaigns for electoral reform. So Neil Lawson has been a member of the Labour Party as long as I have, since the 1970s. But he's set up Compass, and it's got membership, including Labour Party, Liberal Democrats, Greens and Nationalists. And it's an attempt to create a cross-party campaign for proportional representation. But he has been suspended from the Labour Party for being the head of this extremely broad church organisation, because that's the way the Labour Party is being run now by the apparatchiks who've taken over. Well, they were always there, but they've come out of the woodwork once again.
Yeah, the irony is, of course, that he's fundraising, isn't he? You know, I suppose the Labour Party are thinking, well, we don't really care about these like little donations like that. What we want is the hundreds of thousands of pounds from these hedge fund managers.
Well, no. Well, what the
well, yes, it is. That's what they're thinking, isn't it?
Funding for the Labour Party, Tony, was messed up when Starmer came in. Corbyn put the Labour Party in a very strong position financially because of all the new membership. Now, what Starmer did when he came in is, because of the existing legal challenge to the Labour Party from staff members claiming that they were discriminated against as Jews. It was all, you know, they'd taken the party to court. But the lawyers for the Labour Party told Starmer that if they went to court, they would lose. That's what they told him.
So the lawyers are the problem, yeah.
What he did is he chose to settle out of court with those people, many of whom formerly worked for the Israeli embassy, for example. He settled out of court with those people, which cost millions. So those people were given millions of pounds of my money, which I've paid.
Well, and Crispin Flintoff's donations too.
Well, that's right. And of course, what's happening now is what happened under the Blair regime, which is they're trying to liberate themselves, A, from being funded by the constituency membership, and B, by the trade unions, so that they can then get funding from pro-Zionist business bodies.
And the World Economic Forum.
And this is all to do, coming back round in the circle, to the way the electoral system works, which is if you want to get rid of the
Tories... You always blame the electoral system, Martin. You always blame the electoral system, but actually what happened was there was an immense amount of media... trying to frame Jeremy Corbyn as a terrorist in the 2017 election. And also, of course, there was, well, as we now know from the Ford report, a massive amount going on at Labour Party central office to actually make sure he didn't win the election. So it doesn't matter what system you have for elections, under that sort of pressure, there's absolutely no way that somebody like Jeremy Corbyn is going to win it.
I take your point, Tony, but we're still stuck in a first-past-the-post system, as like they've got in the United States of America, and it's only Britain and the US that have this, where if you want to get rid of the other side, you've got to go along with what Starmer's saying.
Well, we do also have monarchies too, don't we?
Close down the debate about PR, which is why he's picked on Neil Lawson.
I'm not saying you're wrong. What I'm saying is that there's all sorts of other reasons why PR is a good idea, and the failure of Jeremy Corbyn is not one of them. Anyway, let's go and have a listen to Crispin Flintoff, a second clip. There's a much longer interview with him, nearly an hour or so, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He does a brilliant roadshow around the country with this Not the Andrew Marr Show. He's basically got a box van with a stage, which was down in Nailsea. It was brilliant down there last Saturday. And here is what, because I said to him, well, what about, I mean, there's loads of people out there, they're saying, you know, you've got to vote Labour, even if you don't like Starmer, because the Tories are so awful.
If someone says to me, what's worse, Starmer or the Conservatives, I'd say Starmer. The reason I'd say that is he has no differences on policy, whether it's foreign policy. I mean, foreign policy, he says he'll follow anything the US does. I mean, where does that lead? Economic policy, he talks about having no money to pay for people who have more than two children if they need benefits. And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. On austerity, he's no different to the Tories. On the NHS, they're talking about outsourcing the NHS to private companies. When you look at the utilities, there's no, wish to have public ownership on any of those. If we look at the education policy, Ofsted is still triumphed by, trumpeted by Labour, and tests and all that stuff that's destroying, creativity of children. It goes on and on. There is no policy that Labour has that is any better than a Thatcherite policy. And as on top of that, you have a party that is, the one that we all suppose is the opposition and the hope for. And if they come into power, and they don't produce anything other than what the Conservatives have been doing since Thatcher, then it's going to lead to a lot of unrest and unhappiness. And I really don't think that it would be a good thing for this country to see a Starmer government, because the other aspect of this that we have to think about is he is so opposed to free speech in the Labour Party, and the way he's behaved within the Labour Party with people he doesn't agree with shows that he will not tolerate any opposition. And I believe you've seen in the votes as well on the policing bill, online bills, people are not being given freedom to express themselves online. He would be very, very authoritarian, and I believe he'd be more authoritarian than a Tory. The question of, you know, what are you going to, you'll just get another 5 years of Tories. Well, maybe we would, but I think that would be better than a Starmer government.
Difficult to argue with him, really. I mean, he's basically saying that everything that you're going to get from Starmer is the same as the Tories, but worse.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think, for example, in Bristol West, where you're sitting, people can vote Green. They can vote Green against the Labour Party quite clearly. They're going to control the council in Bristol quite clearly after the May election.
No, I mean, he's talking about Starmer. Martin, I mean, Martin, you're talking about something completely different than what either he or I were talking about. You're talking about local elections there. What we're actually talking about is whether Starmer is, if Starmer becomes Prime Minister, what kind of Prime Minister he'd make.
Well, I totally agree with the analysis that he's making. Starmer is definitely the NATO candidate. He's the candidate of the City of London. He's definitely, a one of them, undoubtedly so. But then the Tories are one of them as well. So what we've actually got, just like in the United States of America, whoever we vote for, the City of London and NATO win the election. And that's why we've got to have a revolution, Tony, which will include changing the electoral system, as in Northern Ireland, where they had a war to change the electoral system and it was changed. And therefore it doesn't function like that. And it doesn't function like that in Scotland. There's about to be a by-election in Scotland, and the SNP have immediately picked up on this thing of the two-child policy, and they're attacking the Labour Party from the left. You can vote SNP in that constituency.
Well, I mean, I think you're actually misrepresenting Donald Trump, in that he actually did talk about the possibility of pulling out of NATO, didn't he? Which is basically spitting in the church in the international. And there's a lot of people, I would agree with them, saying that, well, it doesn't really matter what Donald Trump says in the United States. He can say anything on domestic policy, just so long as he kowtows to the deep state when it comes to foreign wars.
Well, that's right. And he signed off the assassination of General Soleimani, who was on a peace mission to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but he didn't start a war, did he?
He did. He could have started a war there. That could easily.
I mean, we're going to be talking
to
Don DeBar about all this. It'd be interesting to see what he makes
of it. Well, it's interesting. The point is, in Britain and the United States, we haven't got any options. We're going to have a revolution, and the revolution will involve changing the electoral system. It's only a minor thing. There's lots of other things that are going to be necessary as well, but the electoral system change is absolutely fundamental.
Anyway, let's...
Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales have already done it, which means that there isn't the same pressure to vote Labour in those three
years. I think it would be also useful to hear some of the other speakers from last Saturday, Nailsy down here at the Not the Andrew Marr Show event, which was brilliant, actually. There's all sorts of speakers, including someone who we have on this show from time to time, from Brighton, the first Jewish member of the Labour Party to be booted out. He's now the author of Zionism During the Holocaust, or Zionism and the Holocaust. Can't remember the title of his book, but he was selling a few copies down in Nailsy. That's Tony Greenstein. And this is what he has to say about the trade unions. Because, I mean, I pointed out, and you do, Martin, that the trade unions are quite a robust opposition at the moment, whereas the Starmer Labour Party isn't. Tony Greenstein begs to differ.
I'm secretary of my local Unite branch, and I have been in some conflict, as my branch, with Sharon Graham and the local regional secretary, Sarah Carpenter, if anyone's in the southeast of Unite. I have to say, it's an absolute disgrace that our trade union leaders, instead of standing up to Starmer's neoliberal policies, are appeasing him and giving him carte blanche and getting nothing in return. He made a promise at the Unite conference to repeal the anti-trade union laws. It took him all of 3 days before he reversed that. I mean, he waited a bit longer with his 10 pledges. Do you remember the 10 pledges? Yeah. You should frame them. I mean, they're still up there. Public ownership. Well, that went by the board. Defence of human rights. That. And all the rest of them. So, we live in pretty dark times. We live in an era where someone like Julian Assange, for example, can be imprisoned indefinitely because he revealed the secrets of the war crime committed by the American forces. What kind of society is it that locks up those who expose those secrets but allows the war criminals to go free? And it is unfortunate, but with one or two exceptions, our trade union leaderships are more afraid of their own members than the government and the bosses. It is they who called off the nurses' strike. They who called off all the other strikes. It's the UCU leadership which tried to call off the lecturers' strike. We have, unfortunately, union leaderships which are more concerned with protecting their own privileges and perks than defending their own members. So we have a fight on all fronts. It's called democracy, both within Unite and the rest of the trade union and labour movement.
Tony Greenstein there, author of Zionism During the Holocaust. Zionism and the Holocaust? Fantastic stuff. We've heard so much from him. Martin, what he's saying there is, I mean, of course, this is the same for many people, that they are concerned that a union leader you know, they want to keep their jobs. They don't want the union's money to be sequestered by the government or anybody else or by employers or whatever. So they're actually, in a way, even the way that the union laws are now shaped leaves them running scared.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a spectrum of in the trade union movement between some officials like Mick Lynch are quite outspoken and others less so, and basically Jobsworth. But it's always been the case. I mean, I've been a trade union activist for many, many years, and the structure of the trade unions is, you know, it's a top-down structure, and sometimes the people in charge of it don't have the best interests of the members at heart. But there's, you know, these things have been going on for years, and it's just a continual struggle, and nothing, you know, it's as bad as it's ever been, but it's, you know, this has always been the case.
Also, another speaker there was Dr. David Halpin. We also have him on this show from time to time. It almost felt like, you know, quite a lot of these people that I speak to on Skype were all kind of there on stage. It was rather delight to meet them. So David Halpin had this to say about he was there talking also about the death of Dr. David Kelly. In front of this audience. In fact, it was interesting in a way. It was a bit like that Together Declaration meeting that was held in Bristol a few weeks ago and the one in Bath back in January. But this was a very much a much more left-wing version. But actually, many of the issues that came up were similar, including the health service.
The NHS will be rebuilt because there are some very good people within it. So whenever you can, there's over a million employees in the health service, or they need more. They've been short of staff, about 140,000 staff, 100,000 nurses for quite a long time. Be kind to them, encourage them, and find the best amongst them, and be with them, because we have to be, we work with them, the patient, the lay people, the doctors, the nurses, the physios, all the rest of them. We have to work together to rebuild it, and we will rebuild it, because the perception was beyond imagining. In a bankrupt country, bankrupt from the war, we built a health service, and I was the start of it. I was really quite early in it. In 1964, that's only about 15 years after it started. And I said, we didn't have much to do then. We had much, we didn't have the technology. But we did our best to be good doctors and nurses and whatever. We are all together in this. I have to say this quite bluntly. We have to maintain our own health. It is our absolute duty to look after our own health. And the pandemic we've been talking about, which is grossly exaggerated anyway, with unnecessary vaccination, what I call toxic junk, the pandemic is of obesity. I'll be quite blunt about it. We have to get back to being a healthy nation like we were in the Second World War and recover the common sense we had then and the determination we had then as well to defeat the most evil regime.
So that's Dr. David Halpin. Also there were Ken Loach, the filmmaker, Chris Williamson, MP, former MP, who was stabbed in the back by Jeremy Corbyn, really. I mean, you know, he was treating his friends like Chris Williamson worse than he was his enemies, like Margaret Hodge. So that was Corbyn's big mistake, although there were various other mistakes, of course. So, Martin, you know, this is very sad, isn't it, when you get so many well-known people and actually there's zero coverage by the press, apart from my show, maybe, and, of course, the Not the Andrew Marr show, who put the event on, even though there's all these people getting together in a field in Nailsea. Most of the publicity for these things happens through Facebook. And I just get the impression that Facebook were kind of cranking back not the Andrew Marr show, so maybe didn't they? But there were still a couple of hundred people there to enjoy Saturday afternoon and Saturday evening watching the Jeremy Corbyn film, The Big Lie. But, you know, it could have been more if there had been some sort of publicity for it. Pity, you know. So what do you make of this this form of politics where you've got speakers coming out in a field and it's not even being covered by the press? Some of these people are extremely well known.
Well, we've got to work with what we've got. We've got to use what we have got. I mean, this show, we do it week in, week out. We do have an audience for it. Obviously, not the Andrew Marr show has got an audience for what it does, and it's certainly done enough to annoy the Labour Party apparatchiky. So that, you know, you're having some kind of an effect, aren't you? I think what they're worried about is that some of the memes that we talk about could take off. They're terrified that the society can turn on a sixpence. You know, if some kind of, I think it's very important, for example, to expose the fact that it was NATO who carried out the massacre in the Maidan Square in 2014. All the evidence is there. Now, if that got to be readily understood by the ordinary population, and that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was blown up by the Americans, is what's causing your cost of living crisis, that's why you're in a food bank, then, they are worried that that stuff will cut through. And they're right that it may well cut through, especially if they lose another war, because they've lost the war in Iraq, they've lost the war in Afghanistan, they've lost the war in Libya, they've lost the war in Syria, and they're going to lose the war in the Ukraine. And that's when revolutions do actually happen, when you've had significant military defeat, and that's where they're going, and that's where we're all going. It's going to be a very, very big time of upheaval. This is just the beginnings.
I think you could be right. I mean, particularly with the...
these people to the margin... like Ken Loach, who've been very successful in their careers over many, many years, they are playing with fire.
Yeah, well, there is, since you're bringing up this whole sort of, the cost of living crisis, we've had another increase in interest rates this week, which is going to be a complete and utter disaster. It's completely the opposite to what the policy should be. Much better to have cheap money. I mean, someone was pointing out, I was listening on talk radio this morning, a very basic fact, which is that if you're increasing interest rates, then people with money are more likely to stick them in a bank account to accrue interest than to spend it, because they can get their interest on their money in the bank. This is not what is wanted. You want people to be spending money. So what they're doing, I think, is utterly perverse. This guy, what's his name, the new governor of the Bank of England, Martin?
Andrew Bailey.
Andrew Bailey seems absolutely useless. And in fact, not worse than useless. We have 14 months of interest rate increases, which is just, it's going to cause a massive housing crisis. And there was a chap that phoned in, Mark from Newcastle, to the Mike Graham programme, who I thought was very articulate. He's a landlord, and he's explaining, what they're doing is they're forcing buy-to-let landlords like me to put their properties on the market because it's no longer viable to be renting as the interest rates go up. So he's saying actually what's being started here by the Bank of England and the Jeremy Hunt, by the way, Mr. Useless, he does look as if you wave a hand in front of his eyes and there's nobody in. Maybe he's the perfect person to have for the City of London and to have in the deep state to have a Chancellor of the Exchequer. But he's endorsing these interest rate rises, which are causing, as Mark in Newcastle says here, are going to cause even more hassle and actually chaos in the housing market.
Before you say anything about it, I studied economics at university. Mark's in Newcastle. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing?
Very well, sir. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm a landlord, and I'd just like to put out there that the government is sleepwalking, and the Bank of England, into the greatest housing crisis this country has ever seen. Mm. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. If the interest rates were 0.1, fix your mortgage at about 2.53% on a £100,000 property, that's £300 roughly a month.
Right.
Now, if I'm coming to remortgage, that's going to be around 7.5%.
Mm.
Now, that means that my rent, I receive £600, that rent needs to be £700 to break even.
Yeah.
So myself and a couple of friends of mine who are in landlord business, we're just selling our properties.
Mm.
And what you will see is a devastating cycle of tenants being evicted because you can't make a loss on any business. It just makes no sense.
Mm.
Liverpool Council had an emergency meeting last week to discuss the fact they just can't house the people who are being evicted because landlords just can't afford to keep the properties going.
Yes. And what about the price of housing if you sell it? Because a lot of people are saying the prices are coming down. Does it become difficult at a certain point? If you've had the house for a while, you probably will make some money, but you might not make as much as you thought.
Absolutely. On the one hand, you think, right, well, I make less money on the sale, but otherwise I'm bleeding money every week.
Yeah.
Or every month, every time I get paid.
Right.
Now, to add to that, you have an astonishing tax change which happened a few years ago, which probably went under most people's radar.
Right.
And the government cleverly called it stopping mortgage interest relief for higher earners.
Mm.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Now, no other business in the UK would you be able to be taxed on money you haven't earned.
Right. Well, so they quite like taxing you twice, don't they? They can tax you on the pension and also on the money that you earned before you put the pension money away.
Yes, but this is slightly different. This is very dark, because if you take any business in the UK, you have your turnover.
Yeah.
You then remove all the costs, whether it be staff costs, cost of goods,
right,
rent, electricity, etc. That leaves you with a net profit.
Right.
And then you're taxed on your net profit.
Yes.
Which is, of course, fair.
Right.
The only business in the UK where it doesn't happen is with the landlords.
Mm.
What you have is you have, and this, you may be quite astonished to hear this, you have the turnover, which is regarded to be the rent, which is fine. So
yes,
you've got your total rent.
Right.
From that, you deduct your non-mortgage costs.
Right. So maintenance, that kind of thing.
That's correct. To give you a gross figure.
Right.
Now, if that gross figure then falls below the higher tax threshold, theoretically, you don't pay any more taxes than you did under the old system.
Okay.
However, if your turnover goes above that, you are taxed at a higher rate.
Even though you're actually making less than the higher rate?
Correct, because at that stage, the...
Yeah, that's wrong, isn't it?
Mortgage payments have yet to be deducted.
Yes, that's outrageous.
Yet to be deducted. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so you could actually have a situation which we're approaching with these interest rates where they are today,
right,
where you're paying tax whilst making a loss
right
on your turnover.
That's a shocking state of affairs. You're right. I am actually shocked to hear that. Mark, thank you very much indeed. It's a terrible situation, because also if you are a landlord right now and you are thinking, well, what do I do? Is the interest rate going to go up any more? Is my mortgage going to go up any more? Well, the answer to that's probably going to be yes, isn't it? If you can't guarantee that this won't happen in another month or two, when the government decides, or the Bank of England decides, that they still haven't got inflation under control.
So that's the chap's name's Mark in Newcastle, a landlord talking to Mike Graham on Talk Radio earlier this week. It's difficult to have sympathy for landlords, but there are some out there, Martin, that are thinking to themselves, look, I've got to get out of this game because of the interest rates, meaning that it's just too much uncertainty for the future. And house prices are pretty reasonably high now. The time is to get out now before there's a crash.
Well, as everybody does, that becomes the crash, of course.
Well, that's what he's saying. He's saying that actually the interest rates will be persuading landlords to do that.
Create a crash. That's what the Tories are going to preside over a crash. That's why they're beginning to panic now, because that's not exactly the best situation to be in.
Well, they may start the process of the crash, but it may be that Starmer has to deal with it.
Well, if he wins, he will have to deal with it. But of course, what he's saying, Rachel Reeves is saying, is they're not going to do anything fundamental to challenge the way the system works.
Well, it doesn't work. The system doesn't work.
That's why they'll be on the spot, because the only way to actually deal with it once we get into this major crash is you're going to have to take some pretty strong measures, and they're not the kind of measures that he's thinking of. But of course, he'll be forced to do things, because he'll be forced to do things. Events do boy events. We've got ourselves into a cul-de-sac after 40 years of Thatcherism. We shouldn't have people like myself.
Well, and Blairism. I think you've got to be fair, Martin. Martin, it's Blairism too, isn't it?
Yes, because that was just a continuation.
In fact, Margaret Thatcher was saying that Tony Blair was one of her greatest. She was one of his greatest fans, because he carried on in her tradition.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, it's all on a ratchet. So you can't go back until we come to the very end of the line, which is where we're coming now. The whole of the European economy is not just going to go into recession, it's going to go into a depression that makes the 1930s look like a Sunday afternoon tea party. It may well be that Britain will go there first, because of the specifics of our situation being outside the single market with the higher inflation than everybody else, and therefore higher interest rates to control the inflation.
I mean, is it as simple as Jeremy Hunt and his Chinese agent wife, or maybe she's not an agent, I don't know, but he's just too afraid to admit that the Bank of England's policy is wrong, and it's completely the opposite.
He can't change the policy without changing.
But he can stay. He's supporting it at the moment, so he could be putting out messages saying, "Actually, no, reverse this policy." But he's not going to do that, is he?
TPC and Danny Blanchflower, who used to be on the Monetary Policy Committee, are all saying this is overkill. If I was on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, I would be saying this is overkill. Because you're going to kill the economy, and then, and you're not actually going to do much to stop the inflation, because the inflation isn't being caused by wage increases. Real wages are falling, apart from in the financial sector.
I mean, the one thing that the economy does need is some form of certainty. I mean, this is not... they're saying now also, this is publicly this week, that the interest rate increases are going to carry on until the end of next year.
Well, they're going to carry on doing this because they've only got one club policy, which is what we used to say in the 1980s. They've only got, you know, they're playing golf, but they've only got one club, which they just use
yeah,
it to
and they can't admit it when the club is bent and broken.
Well, that's so, right. But I mean, all of these things, it's not just to do with the Bank of England. It's to do with the privatisation of everything over 40 years. Look at the water companies profiteering away while they dump sewage into the rivers and the beaches. And they should never have been in the private sector at all.
Absolutely right. No. And it would be nice if the Labour Party came up with some sort of proposal to re-nationalise them. This is obviously all these utilities and the merchant venturer shares that are in them. The Bristol, Royal Charter organisation. And of course, you know, they're out there on the share markets. The private equity firms are buying up these things. And it means that if you're a wealthy person, you just buy... £20,000 worth of shares, or maybe less, £10,000 sometimes, in one of these utility companies, and then you're never paying any bills again. And all the people that are paying your bills are the poor people who are struggling. They're paying the rich people's bills. This is how perverse this Thatcherite, Victor Rothschild privatisation system was. But look, I mean, one of our mutual friends, David Southwell, we did the SCADS conference with him, Martin, a long time ago. I think it was 2012, even maybe, in London. He's the author of some fantastic books, and if you haven't got them, please just go and get at least one, and then you buy that one, you'll probably want to get another one of his books. It was The History of Organized Crime, which is we're talking to police sources, intelligence sources in London. He's got a fantastic take on particularly the British organized crime, and the Crays, the Richardsons, and also of course in the United States. There's an absolutely brilliant book, The History of Organized Crime, by David Southwell, and his other one is Secrets and Lies, which is a conspiracy coffee table book with a different conspiracy on every page. It's brilliant, with enough information for you to figure out what's really behind the conspiracy, whether it's real or not. Most of them of course are. So that's David Southwell. We're going to hear from him now. He's kind of disappeared off the radar. He said he was going to be a kind of spy for the people. So we'll see if he emerges with anything interesting in a few years' time. But anyway, here he is talking about financial crimes at the second conference. It was called SCADS. Do you remember what it stood for, SCADS, Martin? Something like...
Sorry, no, I've forgotten.
Democracy, was it? Something, crimes against democracy? No?
Yeah.
Something like that, anyway. Yes, but it was brilliant. On the 17th of March, 2012, David Southwell had this to say about the City of London.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much. I'm going to be talking about crime and money laundering. And so, therefore, the global marketplace. The City of London is wonderful. And Boris is a big defender of the global marketplace happening in London. And London, the City of London, is a fantastic thing. He's very keen on sort of batting back any sort of problems coming from Europe. We mustn't tax London. Don't these people realise that if they have their ridiculous ideas, all of our bankers, they're going to be on the first flight to the East or to America. And it's so important to our economy. It's the financial engine of London and of the UK. And David Cameron is no different. He goes to Europe. The only thing he's concerned about in terms of defending UK rights is the City of London. And Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, they were no different. Every Prime Minister in very recent history has backed the City of London, and they trot out the same statistics over and over again. Over 330,000 people work there. It's 2.5% of our GDP. Of the 4 trillion traded daily on money exchange, 1.85 trillion is traded in London. Almost 40% of the money exchange happening in the world happens in London. And there's this myth that the City of London is good for this country. And I want to put over a view which you don't often hear. And I always get a bit worried because I deal a lot with, I write books on organised crime, and I write books on power politics. I've been a journalist and an author for 20 years. And I always get quite worried when I hear the same things from the criminals and from the police. I really do. And the one thing which I have heard from various senior detectives in the Metropolitan Police, and I've heard from very senior criminals working in organised crime, is that London is the best place in the world to launder money. It is the absolute best place. And one of the organised criminals said to me that the reason London is so good is if you launder the money here, if you make it clean here, you can send it anywhere. You can do anything with it. London is this stamp of authority. You make your money in Russia, you make it in Israel, you send it from Israel to London, you get it cleaned in London, nobody ever asks any questions again. It's the best place in the world. And the Mets say the same things. It's a huge place for money laundering. It's the global centre for money laundering. And very interestingly, the thing that the criminals say and the people in the Met will tell you is money laundering is actually good for London. Not in terms of the money and the jobs and all the things that Boris and David would say, but the fact that the tier one criminals, the people who are doing the money laundering, who are laundering billions daily in London, actually, because they use London as a money laundering capital, they keep a lot of the street crime out of London. Now, in Paris, with the World Cup, over 11,000 prostitutes from Russia were trafficked into Paris and into France to service the World Cup. According to the Met, this isn't going to happen for the Olympics this year, because, as with the extortion and a lot of the other Russian rackets, the tier one criminals who are living in West One, in very nice homes, not paying very much tax, and are doing the really important business of laundering money, do not want the lower levels of the syndicate, the tier two guys, to export problems into London, because it would cause heat, it would cause outcry, it would cause actually more scrutiny, and it jeopardises the really important work, which is money laundering.
So that's David Southwell there speaking in 2012. Martin, I mean, he's really saying that actually, I mean, in a way, of course, this financial crime is at the centre of world crime, isn't it, in London?
It is. And speaking about prime ministers being supportive of the City of London, when John Smith decided he was going to have his prawn cocktail offensive, when he went to talk to all the, you know, the big wigs in the City of London about, you know, what his policy was going to be, that's exactly when the New Zealand guy, Brian Gould, who was deputy leader of the Labour Party, that's when he said, I resigned, because I realised that the Labour Party was not going to do what they should do, which is discipline the City of London. And then he went off to New Zealand to be a university vice-chancellor.
Well, it's very similar to the Bretton Woods conference too, isn't it, where there's absolutely a line between politics and the elected officials and the city. Now it seems to me it's the other way around, that the City of London lobby is absolutely in the driving seat. It's driving things like the oil prices, the abilities of supermarkets to fix their prices upwards. I mean, some of the stuff I've seen, yeah, literally going up 200, or no, it's 100, I suppose it's from £1 to £2.50 in the space of a year, 18 months. I mean, this is just price fixing. And that sort of thing is exactly what the City of London want. And they're getting it from Rishi Sunak and this government.
Well, they are. And what needs to happen is the City of London needs to be disciplined. And the, Brian Gould was from the New Zealand Labour Party tradition. And they, you know, their attitude is, you know, we've got to discipline the financial sector. But of course, the whole thing about Blairism and Starmerism and Rachel Reeveism, which is where we are now, is that they do not want to take the City of London on. It's the if you can't beat them, join them syndrome. And of course, ultimately, the 2008 crash just showed how vulnerable this whole thing is. They were bailed out, of course, and therefore they've passed all of the costs onto the ordinary folk, which is why we've got all this cost of living crisis and all the rest of it. But ultimately, the system itself is dysfunctional because it's parasitic. As Richard Murphy points out, who's a tax justice network economist, you could easily raise a hell of a lot more money in tax just by, you know, there's plenty of low hanging fruit. You could all sorts of things you could do to increase the tax take on the City of London. But of course, none of it's ever done because they're too powerful. And ultimately, they're going to have to be taken on. And of course, there is also the possibility that the whole system itself is in crisis now. This is to do with long run trends, to do with technology and things of this sort, you know, AI, getting rid of loads and loads and loads of jobs, and these people not getting other jobs, which means that there isn't enough demand in the economy to make it function. But of course, we've now got alternatives emerging, you know, the BRICS conference in South Africa in Johannesburg in the end of August will bring together all of the rest of the world to talk about what they're going to do about our City of London and our military and its attempts to try and dominate the planet. We're coming to, you know, we're reaching the point where, you know, the inflection point for all of these things is rapidly approaching.
I mean, you do talk about a crash, and you've been doing that since we started the show in 2008, Martin. I tend to think that the elites will just simply allow the middle classes and, you know, small, medium businesses to collapse. And as a result of that, well, they'll just buy them up cheap. And all the time that's going on, they're not going to allow there to be a crash. That what they'll do is they'll keep feeding the beast until they own almost everything.
Well, what's going to happen is that Western Europe and Eastern Europe are going to be cannibalized by the US. The blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline basically makes Germany, which is the powerhouse of Europe, uncompetitive. And the German industrialists are having to move either to China.
So much of this is interesting, isn't it? So much of this is about energy costs. By jacking up the price of energy, which is what a lot of the so-called Greens want to do, is really just making countries uncompetitive. It's putting lots and lots of people out of work. And I mean, cheap energy doesn't mean to say you're just going to burn it as if there's no tomorrow. But what it does mean is that you can actually make things, you can manufacture things, you can get around, and maybe, you know, we should be looking at this whole. It's interesting. I haven't heard anything. Maybe I should interview him, Ken Livingstone, about his Fares Fair policy, because he wanted to do free public transport in London, which would have brought about clean air, with very little use of the car, without having all these extra taxes. On and of course they're just taxing people to pollute. Much better to have people using public transport. Well, I mean, I was just thinking the other day, it was 5p a ticket to get to school when I was first going to school, aged whatever it was, 12 or something, and the buses came every 15 minutes or every 6 minutes, something like that, and it was really cheap to get around, very easy. And of course this was before privatization.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are roads not taken. You know, we're now path dependent. Yeah. So because we did all of these things, you can't just rewind the video and do it again, because you can't.
Yeah, but we're getting to the stage where, I mean, here in Bristol, lots of the bus routes have just been lots of actual bus services have been cut. Some of the routes have been cut, and what's happening is it's getting down to the point where only the very highest profit margin routes are going to be run by these privatised companies anymore. That means there is no kind of comprehensive public transport or reliable public transport system.
Well, that's right, and all sorts of other systems have been similarly looted. This is looting. And it's been going on for generations, which is why productivity per hour is so rubbish in this country, because we don't invest in people. We don't invest in plant and machinery, because the money's all been siphoned off to the City of London to keep the people there in the style to which they've become accustomed. Nobody at the top has had any kind of reduction in their income or their wealth as a result of all the policies that have been pursued since 2008. I was looking at an article earlier saying the super wealthy are wealthier than they ever were before the crisis began. That's because they've managed to shift the whole basis of the crisis onto the backs of the ordinary people. And the ordinary people, of course, can bear that weight to some extent. But even they, once you start pushing them out of work, which is what's going to happen when we had a crash, is that you can't just expect that it will rebuild itself. It won't. We have the government will have to intervene. And of course, this is what Starmer ought to be thinking about. But of course, he isn't.
Well, so there's also just one local story this week. We've got our Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees. Well, last May, the city voted to get rid of the post of mayor. And this last weekend, there was the, I thought, very surprising news that the Labour Party's procedures for seeing who's going to be their candidates for this new Bristol parliamentary seat to be an MP, to be a candidate for there. Marvin Rees, the current mayor, has lost that. So it's going to be the one of, it's a politician, Labour politician from South East London. Not far from Lewisham, where, not far from where I was brought up, was going to be the candidate in that seat. So it really does look as if not only the people of Bristol have snubbed the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, but also the Labour Party itself, Martin, and the Voice newspaper has labelled Bristol's the Bristol 24/7 has done an article about the Voice article where they're saying, which is, you know, is a little bit more balanced, where the Voice editor slams Bristol's turnip munching racists. The editor of the UK's only black national newspaper has blamed Bristol's turnip munching racists for Marvin Rees not being selected by Labour members in Bristol North East. Lester Holloway was responsible to Damien Egan being selected over Bristol's mayor to be Labour's candidate for the new constituency. Rees has twice won a citywide vote to be elected mayor, but failed to convince Labour members that he should be their prospective parliamentary candidate. I think it's mainly because Marvin is not being popular as a Labour mayor here in Bristol, and he got where he is today as mayor, largely on the back of the Labour Party framed by Jeremy Corbyn. Writing in The Voice, Holloway said that the Bristol has shafted its black mayor again, in brackets, adding that Rees's defeat speaks volumes about a city with a history of racism denial. Whilst Rees was re-elected in 2021, his period as city mayor was already scarred by constant criticism. He was accused of vainglorious self-promotion and globe-trotting jollies when he flew abroad to try and drum up business for Bristol, even though other metro mayors did exactly the same thing. So is there any justification, do you think, for The Voice to be labelling Bristol as a racist city, Martin?
Well, there's residual racism everywhere, including in Bristol. I think they're wrong about this. The Labour Party membership in Bristol North East, as it now will be, decided that they wanted to have this guy, Damien Egan. I can't remember his name. Even, is it? Oven? What's the name?
Yeah,
of the guy?
I just said it. Yeah, it's somebody Egan. Yeah,
he is in fact a local boy because he was born in Kingswood.
Damien Egan. Yeah,
yeah. He was born in Kingswood, so he is local in the sense that he comes from Bristol originally, even though he's been mayor of Lewisham. I think that's a matter for the Labour Party membership in that constituency. And Marvin Rees, to be fair, has said that he's perfectly happy to campaign on behalf of the person who won the nomination. You can't, you're not guaranteed the nomination. You can put your name forward, but then you've got to convince the people who've got the vote whether they think you should be the candidate. And he just didn't, you know, they've decided not. There we are.
So the Bristolian, the Bristol 24/7 blog is speculating that Marvin Rees will end up instead of the House of Commons, will be going to the House of Lords. So do you think that's where he'll end up?
I've no idea. I mean, he's got various skills. He's not going to be out of a job. He's just got to decide what sort of a job he wants. He could probably try and get to be selected as an MP in another part of the country. He wanted to be selected as a prospective candidate in Bristol because he's focused a lot of his political energies in Bristol.
Well, I don't know if you remember.
Of course, he doesn't have to stay in Bristol. I don't know
if you remember, but the former MP, Liberal Democrat MP, Stephen Williams, said on our programme when we were on FM, he said that that Marvin Rees, he'd got this from people very close to Marvin, that Marvin really wanted to be the first black merchant venturer. Well, he won't be, because Marty Burgess, it's mixed race, Marvin is, but Marty Burgess was the first woman black merchant venturer. But do you think we'll see Marvin joining the city's Illuminati?
I've no idea. You'd have to ask him. I don't know.
Well, he won't answer questions. Maybe once he's out of politics, he might be a little bit more accessible. Well,
he may stay in politics in some other capacity, or he may move sideways into something else. He's got a fairly, upgraded CV. He's going to do something. You know, he could run a charity, for example. There's all sorts of things he could do. We'll just have to see. I mean, it's up to him, isn't it?
Well, he's already on various boards of things, including film companies and stuff, so he might just decide he wants to concentrate there. Anyway, I mean, the system is going to... How's the city going to change, do you think, with a committee system, going back to the committee system, rather than having a mayor, Martin?
Well, we'll go back to how it was before, but there's a big change, which is that looks like the Greens are going to be the largest party.
Yeah.
And they've been running Brighton City Council for years with mixed results. But Bristol, if they come in to be running Bristol, they'll have to, from a national point of view, they'll want to be seen as doing a good job.
And it looks as if Marvin Rees has been responsible for losing the city for Labour. Really, I mean, that's why maybe that they're not. These Labour Party members in Bristol, North East, or wherever it is, are going to decide they don't want him because the Labour vote has been falling away massively since Marvin became mayor. But anyway, look, all these political upheavals of various kinds and changes in the system, and this one is a positive one, thank God, getting rid of the mayor and going back to actually our elected councillors having the power again, and the largest party being the leader of the council rather than having any kind of mayor, a mayor's office. So, I spoke to this publican on picking up really on the what we were talking about earlier with these kind of roadshows going around the country. Well, there's going to be a kind of freedom festival over in Leicestershire, just east of Leicester, at a place called Syston. Because I picked up this is one guy called Bill Donoghue, who's a publican, former engineer. And he was running a pub during the lockdown and became a very popular place for people to go to after the lockdowns had finished. And also during the lockdown, because what he said was, well, people can come to my garden in the pub, bring their own drinks. And he set himself up as somebody who was there to keep the whole idea of people being able to talk to each other, socially distanced, of course, and the police were coming to check on that sort of thing. He then, after all of this, has got booted out of his pub, but he got, so the brewery kicked him out, and he's going through a case at the moment with the Employment Tribunal with them, which we didn't really get into, and the longer version of this will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So here's Bill Donoghue talking about his experience, and he's going to be having this Freedom Festival at Syston in Leicester next weekend to sort of celebrate, bring people together from all around that area who were appreciated his ability to not just simply close the pub, but to allow people to come along and bring their own drinks, sit in the garden and socially distance.
I did get covered with the furlough, which that did help, but I'd have rather been open. And it was just all the madness that went with it. When we could open, you can walk in with a mask on, sit down, take it off, put it on to go to the toilet. It was ridiculous. I followed all the rules. But I did go petitioning to London at every opportunity. And because of that, I ended up in a video on one occasion by a gentleman called Will, who runs a site called GB Resistance, I think it is. And he happened to film me walking along merrily. And he says, oh, because we'd spoke before. He said, oh, how's your pub going? And I happened to mention it and where my pub was. And then after it come out, people who were like-minded to me started coming to my pub. And it was really good. We had, takings were good. Takings went up. It was just all lovely people that just thought something was amiss.
Was this a time when the pubs were supposed to be closed or what?
No, but when the pubs were closed, when we were meant to be closed, I don't mind admitting it, I did let my customers in every day, but when the police turned up, they came 11 times, called on me 11 times apparently, I would simply say, no, sir, these gentlemen sitting there in their bubble, show them your receipts, lad. So they bought their beer from Aldi, and they got there some Tesco, so I'm not selling alcohol, I'm just letting these gentlemen sit in there. And officers, you didn't join the police force to stop widowers getting together at this time of age. Go out and catch some real criminals. Some of the officers were very good. Some of them took offence, but I had to remind them, it's not the law, is it? It's regulations, and I'm following your regulations.
Oh, that is fascinating. How did you get on with some of the police that agreed with you and were fine?
On one occasion, we were actually sitting outside. We had I had a fire going. It was winter, but they actually pulled a chair up and sat with us. Other occasions, they were trying to say that you got to disperse, but, you know, the specials, I was a bit cheeky. I'd tell them, you know, go and get a dinner lady that's got more authority than you. But I'm always courteous to the police. I'm fully on support of them. But it was ridiculous. I have to remind them, you didn't join the police to do this, you know, and it's affecting you. Get a grip. But, on the whole, I've got a good, I never had a problem with the police. They came and they went. But, you know, obviously the neighbours next to the pub were, oh, there's something going on. I mean, I had the police come to me one time. Coming in. You had a party on here last night. I'm thinking, well, you didn't. Get looking at the cameras. It was just me and my mate, one mate, but we had the music on loud and we had a beer, you know. But the neighbours report, he's got a party on. I didn't. I never sold any alcohol during the lockdown, but I did let people bring their own in. Because a lot of them were just old boys, you know, widowers. So what are you supposed to do?
So that's Bill Donahue there. He's got a event next weekend in Syston in Leicestershire, which is called the Freedom Festival. So I'm just looking up whereabouts that is. So Bill, he has sent me these various bits and bobs here. Oh, here we go. Yeah, Freedom Festival, Friday the 11th to Sunday the 13th of August 2023, Syston and District Social Club, Leicester, LE71GP. They do have a website, frpromotions.com, I guess that is. But anyway, FR Promotions, all sorts of speakers, Debbie Hicks, Jonathan Tilt, and music too. So that's well worth a look if you're in that part of the country. Friday the 11th to Sunday the 13th of August 2023. And I'll put a link up to the full interview with him on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Not sure if he'll have much luck getting that publicised by the mainstream press in that part of the country. But there is this thing on Telegram he talks about in the longer interview called the Tribe of Leicestershire. Which is a lot of people who are very concerned about the way our politics is going and our press, our mainstream press is going in Britain, getting together really on these social media outlets to share knowledge and share information and also, of course, get together, get organised. Anyway, I'm joined on the line now by Don DeBar from in New York. Hi, Don.
Hey,
guess why we're talking to you again?
Why?
well, we've had some interesting news about a certain Mr. Trump this week. But before we get to that, I know last time we spoke, you said you were off to China.
I was off to China, and I was off to Switzerland, and off to Germany, and off to France.
So anyway, China particularly. We've been trying to cover this whole business of the Uyghur Muslims in the west of China for a long time. And I think, you know, I have to say, I've sort of left it with a bit of a mystery question mark over it, really, as to whether this is just Western propaganda or whether there's, you know, there really is a fear by the Chinese Communist Party of Muslims, which they're overreacting to and incarcerating people with no real cause. So when did you go there and what did you find?
I was there from the 28th of June until the 13th or 14th of July. I forget when I left. And I was in Urumqi. But if the people that are familiar with the map of the continental United States, China looks approximately the same shape. And so for reference, Urumqi is in the northwest, about where Seattle or Portland, Oregon might be on a map of the United States. I went there first.
Or Liverpool in England, yeah.
Yeah, well, and the shape. But it's
the wrong shape, UK. So,
wrong shape and size. But the US and China are kind of about the same size and shapes, is what I'm using as a reference. Then about where Salt Lake City is, I went to Dunhuang. And then about where Chicago is, I went to Xi'an. And then about where Atlanta, somewhere between Atlanta and Memphis, I went to Nanjing.
So you're doing it sort of anti-clockwise a bit, yeah?
Yes, and what came the path of the Old Silk Road, and this is was the path of entry of people that are now Muslims in China, but who first arrived there before Muhammad, before Islam. They were trading then from Europe and the Middle East, and people settled there over the years. You know, I'm on my way to get silk and bring it back and trade it for whatever the hell the Europeans traded for. and hey, this is a nice place. I think I'll stay here and set up shop. And over the centuries, that's how these cities, you know, these communities that became cities in the northwest and central and even the southeast of China were settled and developed. And so just the very idea that the Chinese Communist Party or that you know, Chinese people in general or the nation of China is afraid of Muslims is absurd, because they were a constituent part of China preceding its actual existence as a nation.
Well, hang on, Don, because it's not so absurd, is it? Because we've seen ever since the 1980s and Charlie Wilson's war, an attempt mainly by the NATO countries to weaponize Islam, yeah. You know, in a similar sort of way that as Judaism was weaponized with the Zionists, and, you know, Christianity has been with the Christian Zionists. So there is an attempt to kind of hijack these faiths and that's use them for geopolitical purposes, isn't there?
Yeah, and I have some more, you know, more information on that too, with it, that, you know, leans in that direction, which is that due to this history, and is an integral part of this history, even today, you know, Westerners tend to think of China as like a regimented, you know, paranoid, militaristic society. The borders with the countries to the west of China, you know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, you know, on and on and on, all these Muslim countries. They're porous. It's actually sort of laughable to call it a border. Of course, it's not like you can just drive a Jeep through it, because you've got like the Himalayas to climb, and there are other mountains that are par with the Himalayas that are in this part of the country. But for example, in Urumqi, when I was in Urumqi, and I went through this area in the mountains that we went up to visit. I usually don't do any tourist things when I travel, but I got roped into doing two tourist things in China. And one of them was this lake that's almost like a crater in a mountain, like a volcanic lake or whatever. It's not that, but it's shaped like that, called Heavenly Lake. And it is a good 45 minutes to an hour driving into the mountains, like, and up. And about halfway up, because they have tour buses full of tourists, they do in China like they do everywhere in the world. We pull over about halfway and so-call the tourists for whatever we can. And so for us, it was disembark from the bus and walk through the woods for a couple of miles flat. It was nice and comfortable with, you know, foliage and well-trimmed. And on both sides, food stands. You know, ceremonial and historic dance and music and T-shirts and all of this, you know, walking through all of it. And this was a Kazakh community that is, you know, indigenous to this area pretty much. It's hard to say if this is China or Kazakhstan, because there are these Kazakhs that have been there forever. This was common throughout the northwest and central China. We stayed in the time that I was there, in the Muslim quarters, in each of Dunhuang and Urumqi and Xi'an and Nanjing. So these are all – and China's cities, you know, China's ancient country, you know, we know this. And so the cities, you have the old town, like in places in Europe and particularly in Britain, where they're still intact, and then the city that grew up kind of around it. In this part of the country, the people that inhabit, the people that built and inhabit the old towns are these Muslim groups, who are the ones that founded the cities 1,000 years ago, before they were Muslims. And then this beautiful cities rise up around them. Well, we spoke with people, asking them things like, well, you know, are you here in a ghetto? Like, it seems like all the folks that are, you know, the mosque and everything, it's all, and this is all part of the town. No, this is ours. This has always been ours. They built that other stuff around us. We can live there if we want to. We want to live here. The services, the road maintenance, the, you know, all of the things that are infrastructure, that are public, you know, the what they call the commons, all of that is as well maintained or better in these areas than it is anywhere else in the city, where these modern, you know, luxury apartment skyscrapers that are built for the workers, by the way. People were wide open to talk. Nobody was, you know, looking at us furtively, wondering if we were with some secret police group or whatever. I videotaped conversations with people. They spoke freely. They were warm, generous, happy.
How did you cope with the language, Don?
We met people, we had some folks that we met through the hotel, some people we met just going into the marketplace and hanging out. Students saw us. In the Northwest, there's not a lot of Europeans, and one of the members of our group is African-American, and so we were kind of like visual oddities to people, and it attracted some people. A couple of children came up and touched our skin, like, and stuff like, what is this? So some college students would come over to talk to us to practice their English. And we'd ask them questions about this, that, and they'd say, oh, well, come, I'll introduce you to so-and-so. And we'd go into a store, and they'd speak in Chinese or in Arabic, or in, there's some other languages, too. The Uyghurs, for example, they have three or four languages that are all sort of a conglomeration of the things that developed there historically that are theirs. These things are, by the way, not being suppressed like Foreign Policy Magazine would say. Foreign Policy Magazine yesterday, and the teaser they send out with your five stories of the day or whatever, we're talking about how China is knocking down mosques because they would rather brutalize than engage Muslims. And, you know, if I hadn't been to a madrasa speaking with people about their life there and watching them like expand and polish it and everything, and hadn't gone to several mosques that are thriving in these cities, I might buy into that a little bit. But I didn't see any evidence of any of the slander that's being, or any of these, you know, accusations that are being, I call them slander because I'm looking at it against a factual basis, as limited as it is, that I have. And you know, I don't see this as being any different than any of the other piles of stuff. And I know that we have this other problem. You know, the other problem is that the Saudis and the CIA and all of those characters invented this particular toxic strain of quote-unquote Islam that they were able to infect a good part of the Islamic community around the world with the intention of destabilizing all these different countries. Certainly, China, which has figured out how to survive whatever the West throws at it so far, is aware of this, and certainly there are countermeasures, but there did not seem to be anything that impacted the lives of the people that I saw, and I saw lots of people.
So, I mean, we had a kind of similar thing, didn't we, back in the 1990s, I think around early 90s, in Bosnia, with the concentration camps that were being shown to British people back in those days. Martin, because you were actually an aid worker over there, you can say something about this. I mean, what, you know, it seems possibly, Don, that people were being arrested and then moved away from these areas, but you say you don't think that was taking place.
You'd have a sense of something. You have five senses, and you can, most of the time are not reliable in terms of telling.
So
you everything.
So you were actually in the Xinjiang province, were you?
Yeah. For like about a week and a half. Yeah.
So just getting on to this other the story from 1990s. I think it was 92. But we had a lot of pictures here of Bosnian concentration camps. I think they were Bosnian Muslims that were being incarcerated, Martin. Maybe you can say something about that, because I know at the end of the day, although this went all the way around, certainly around the British press, I don't know about elsewhere, there was some sort of expose that actually things weren't quite as they seemed. So the idea of showing people in concentration camps is obviously a very powerful one to do on the television, and it sounds to me as if what we're seeing is not quite, you know, what's happening on the ground.
The mighty Wurlitzer of Western propaganda distorts everything that we see and hear. And that was as true of what was going on in former Yugoslavia as what's going on today in Xinjiang and other parts of the world. There's a huge attempt to manipulate public opinion in the West. Look at the white helmets in Syria, who are basically creatures of the Western intelligence services, and then being used to brainwash the population in Europe and the US to support the, basically Al-Qaeda terrorists trying to overthrow the government of Syria. But I mean, all of these things go on. And that doesn't mean that it is often complex, you know, because, you know, if there is a terrorist threat, then the state is going to take some actions against that, aren't they? Obviously, the Chinese government are very worried about the East Turkestan movement based in Turkey, which is, and of course, there's lots of Uyghurs inside the Idlib pocket in Syria, learning how to fight. And the Chinese army actually liaises with the Syrians and the Russians to keep an eye on them. The whole world is on edge here, and we're being manipulated all the time.
Yeah, so going back to Bosnia, Martin, just picking your brains on this one, 25 years it took for Ratko Mladic to be jailed for life at the International Criminal Court. And when he was, a lot of the media were putting out pictures of the 1992 concentration camp saying, well, at last, you know, justice has been done. But, of course, there's much more to what was going on at the International Criminal Court, as we know, than, you know, we are being told in this rather simplistic view of the story.
Well, that's right. I mean, to be honest with you, the situation in Bosnia was very complex because you've got three major communities, Catholic, Croatians, Serbian Orthodox and Muslims who'd lived together for many generations. But in the Second World War, there's all sorts of memories of that, it was complex. You know, there were some Muslims, for example, fought Fikret Abdic in the Bihać pocket. He was a local bigwig, but he was a Muslim, and he fought on the Serbian side against the Bosnian army. That's because civil wars can be very, very complex. There's not just two sides. There can be three sides, and possibly even, you know, within those sides, there's internal struggles within these different camps.
Okay. Don, back to you. You're, as part of your tour, have you got any other... Because, I mean, it sounds like you've been jetting around the world, really, and also to Europe. Are there any other things you would like to relate from that?
Well, I'm just on this point first, because it's interesting also. We're looking at the same phenomenon, by the way, now around Niger and West Africa generally. You know, the very same people who have murdered more Muslims around the world than any 10 contenders are the ones in places like the former Yugoslavia and China that hold themselves out as the defenders of the rights of Muslims against being slaughtered by others. We're seeing now the United States, you know, Antony Blinken showing up at the UN yesterday, and he's going to be the protector and defender of human rights in Africa. You know, sitting next to people that have installed AFRICOM. If you go to AFRICOM's website at the same time that you listen to Blinken speaking at the Security Council yesterday, you'd ask yourself, who snuck the blotter acid into my coffee?
Well, since you bring up Niger, let's have a listen to a report on, because we've had two big things happen. There's the coup in Niger and also an enormous conference about a week and a half ago with the Russians the whole of Africa, with essentially the South Africans, for example, saying, well, we actually think the Russians are doing a great job here. So let's have a listen to a brief Al Jazeera report on that.
Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, remains detained in the presidential palace after he was overthrown by soldiers in a coup. There were violent demonstrations in support of the military takeover. The UN aid agency has suspended its humanitarian operation, and major global powers are calling for a return to democracy. Russia's president has promised to supply a small amount of free grain to six African countries. Vladimir Putin made that pledge during an economic forum in St. Petersburg, and it comes days after Moscow withdrew from the Black Sea grain deal. Putin is seeking to reassure African leaders that Russia is a reliable partner amid concerns about rising food prices and shortages.
An interesting phrase in there was demonstrations in support of the coup. What do you make of all this? Because they were waving Russian flags. It almost seems to me, Don, as if this coup has been organised by the Russians in order to sort of be the icing on the cake for their conference in Africa.
Well, you know, it's interesting that it seems that way when one considers that it wasn't the Russians, but rather the Americans who've trained the bulk of the officer class.
Yeah, and the French have been the NATO faction that's now been forced to leave. The French are now out.
Yeah, okay, and it only took 150 years. You know, Russia doesn't walk into tabula rasa and have a conversation with people and say, hey, let's get mean and beat up on those French. This has been bubbling there, you know, since the things that led to Bandung back in the 50s and to Lumumba and others, you know, rising up in the 50s and 60s and the suppression of that and neocolonialism and, you know, the dragging out of Bagbo in 2010 from the presidential palace by French troops at gunpoint and installation of a guy straight out of the IMF, Ouattara, as the head there, so that they could continue to print the currency for Cote d'Ivoire, which is a neighbor of Niger in Paris, printing francs for Cote d'Ivoire, where they don't even use francs in France anymore. They use euros. What happened with Gaddafi and Libya and across Africa, what's been percolating for how many decades now in Congo, all across the African continent for the last 300, 400, 500 years, this has been the private garden of Western capital. The people there are aware of that because it's been done on their backs. And when they see a slight opportunity to shed some of it, they rise up. The same people who are complaining that this is a coup, I'll remind you that none of them have a concern about the constitutional government in Ukraine, in Cote d'Ivoire, as I mentioned, where the constitutional court ruled who the president would be, Mel Zelaya, Dilma Rousseff, Evo Morales, you know, on and on and on. There are so many heads of state that were in power under the constitution of that country that were removed either overtly or covertly by the United States, and the United States sided against that constitutional order. So to portray this even in that context without looking at who's representing the interests of Western capital and imperialism as opposed to some other indigenous force, whether it's an indigenous bourgeoisie or the people or even some self-serving officer corps, that's really what it is. It's a national uprising against globalism. It's a manifestation of it.
So what's your take on these latest charges against Donald Trump?
Well, he's running for president. First he won the presidency in 2016, even though that wasn't supposed to happen. And, of course, for the entire time since then, the media has called him every name possible. The election was stolen with the help of the Russians. The election was illegitimate. He's not my president. They said it from the floor of Congress, both houses, from the chairs, from even from inside his own administration and his own cabinet. Across the board in the media, all of that, he was removed in an election that was at least suspicious that you're not allowed to speak about. And then you had this circus that took place January 6, 2021. And he's indicted now, let's see, first of all, paperwork problems in New York that are minor, that lapsed under the statute of limitations, that suddenly they find a new creative way of charging him with. That was the first cut, the first indictments against him that made it possible to have an ongoing narrative about Trump's indictments in the media. With in a state where the attorney general candidate ran on one platform, I'm going to get Donald Trump. That was Letitia James. That's all she was going to do. She got elected on that basis. New York is a Democratic state, and they don't talk about anything else in front of a Democratic audience except the evil Donald Trump. He's now looking at these are charges that compare it to Navalny's case. Okay, Trump is not a threat to the constitutional order. If he had an election tomorrow, he'd probably win it. Navalny, if he can gather 100 people and march up and down the street in Moscow, it's a lot. And yet, look at the media coverage of the two here and there where you are.
Let's just have a little listen, because one of the things that I quite like about Donald Trump is that, as I think one of his speeches he says, he likes it when he gets another indictment because it energizes him. Mm-hmm. And certainly this is reflected in the polls. Certainly the U.S. population, yep. Every time the Department of Justice goes for him, he seems to go up a few points in the polls. Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, it's a circus, isn't it? I mean, I would never vote for Donald Trump, but clearly what's going on here is, you know, they're just thinking of anything, really. And they're just trying to demonize him in every possible way. And, of course, it's not going to work. as you say, Tony, it just actually draws attention to him. He thrives on it, and he's quite likely going to win, I suggest, unless there's some big upset. RFK is obviously trying to do something from outside.
Yeah, well, let's get Don's view on that. Don, what do you think? I mean, you know, what's going on on the Democrat side as we look towards 2024? Do you think Robert Kennedy's in with a good chance?
Oh, yeah. He may well be the next president of the United States. And there's so much going on around that. I just want to say, as far as Trump goes, there's this real interesting contradiction, this dialectical thing about his primary appeal as a candidate, as a political figure, is as a contrarian. He says the system is rigged. People have like a visceral sense of that. We're getting screwed. There's no way for me to get out of this. Everything is stacked against me. And so as he says this, and as he says how corrupt the system is, they prove it visually and repeatedly. It's as if someone somewhere in some marketing firm is saying, let's let him carry the message out there and let's reify it in the minds of the people observing this by actually behaving like and rigging the system in front of them. No serious analyst considers that there's any unique illegality with anything that Trump's done that it hasn't been done by every leading politician in the United States since they killed Kennedy. And yet there's a pile on here, you know, that makes like a rush hour accident, you know, in the snow or something. Look like a sideshow. Again, I don't know. He says if he's convicted of everything he's charged with right now, he gets like 568 years or something. That's more than Son of Sam. Hmm.
Wow. Well, look, I mean, we're talking about, I think, here is a corruption. We had some youngsters here in the studio before you joined us, Don, who have been charged with rioting here in Bristol. One of them has done a bit of time in jail. And we're looking at some pretty horrific miscarriages of justice here in the UK, too. The idea is to sort of penalise and persecute young people for standing up for the British government and Priti Patel, particularly, trying to get rid of the right to protest. And, of course, that is simply not going to happen. They can legislate all they want. But they're trying to use the courts to scare people and punish people in such a way, which is actually, I think, making things worse. And maybe that is, at the end of the day, the object of this, Don. What do you think? It might actually to create a kind of, almost like a kind of civil war situation, eventually. They don't seem to care. It's a very high-risk strategy, taking Trump on in this way.
Yeah, you know, it's like a chaos strategy. Not like it's a chaos strategy. You look around the world. I noticed this when I first started going deep into Latin American politics, but you see it manifest pretty much everywhere, and particularly in the United States also over the last 30, 40 years. There's two cohorts in the society that composed of whatever elements there are that just by chance of history or design, whatever, constitute like 51 and 49% of the population with, you know, a good 4%, 5% shift from time to time between the two. So you've got basically a population at war with itself constantly. You can look at elections across Latin America like this. You can look at the presidential elections in the United States like this, the congressional elections in the United States like this. And it's interesting that this is the phenomenon nationally, because at an atomic level, for example, I live in Westchester County in New York. Well, look at the states. Some states, most states, are either decidedly Democratic or Republican states. They will elect a Democratic governor, Democratic senators, any statewide office, Democrat or Republican, depending on where you are. And maybe there's anywhere, depending on the year and political conditions, from 6 to 14 of the 50 states that are in flux, and they're close. They call those, you know, a variety of different names. But this is the battleground for national elections. You know, if it's a coincidence that human society splits into two cohorts, or that there's something intrinsic about us that does this, then okay, you know, make your case. I'm interested. I'll entertain it.
Well, okay, I will tell you. You talk to the military, they call it hardening the sides. They like forcing people into these two different camps, and sometimes they'll lie and they'll cheat and they'll steal and do whatever they have to do to force people to take sides.
Yep. I mean, this is like the British and the European strategies of colonization, for example. You walk into a place and there's country A and country B side by side, and the division line between them is a horizontal line. And instead, you blur that horizontal line out, impose a vertical line, and now you have two new states that are half and half of the two nationalities at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. And now you walk in and walk out with the gold. Because they're busy fighting with each other.
That's right. Anyway, look, let's have a listen before we say goodbye to you, Don, to Donald Trump speaking. He's obviously been talking after his hearing this week, but he did one of his rallies, although he does repeat himself quite a lot in these rallies, it's always, you can see why people want to go to the rallies, because the mainstream press is not saying a lot of the things that he's saying at these rallies, and they're almost like kind of stand-up comedy routines when he starts talking about Joe Biden and various other aspects of policy. But anyway, here is Donald Trump this week in Erie, Pennsylvania, talking about this whole concept of their, you know, listen, they're going to prosecute or persecute me. That prosecution is just persecution.
Savage criminals are being set loose in Democrat-run cities while innocent Republicans are being viciously persecuted. Men are competing in women's sports. Can you believe that? Not anymore. Not anymore. Day one, that'll end. And the worst and most incompetent president of all time is stumbling us right into the brink of nuclear war. You know that's happening. I said that a long time ago. That's happening. But all of that ends when we win a crushing victory on November 5th, 2024. On day one of my new administration, I will seal the border. And by the way, we want people to come in, but they have to come in legally. Legally. I will save the economy. I will purge the deep state. And I will prevent World War III, which is where we're headed.
So that's Donald Trump speaking earlier this week in Erie, Pennsylvania. He does sound like he's on a roll, actually, and he could well win. And also that the deep state's attempts to put him in jail may actually force the issue and make him win.
Mm. You know, I've been covering Kennedy's campaign some. I've been gone for a month, but I was at the kickoff in April in Boston, and I followed him around New Hampshire and Massachusetts during May and June. I interviewed him also, I think, in April and again in early June. And I've been trying to float to the campaign, I spoke with Dennis Kucinich a couple times, who's a campaign manager, and say, look, what you guys need to do, find some way to get with Trump's people, because Kennedy is being frozen out of the media except to be pilloried. You know, they play like little clips and then they talk about for 2 hours how crazy he is and such. You guys need to start a dialogue, a series of debates, discussions, town halls, whatever. Have Tucker Carlson or somebody else that's a big draw as the moderator or the face of it or whatever, and just get this conversation that in each case is a counter-narrative to this crap we've been fed for decades now out in front of as many people as you can. In my opinion, the only thing that's going to stop he's right when he's talking about being close to World War III. Right? We're in it in a way. And you know, the in so many ways, for the people in the United States and also in Britain and in Europe, you know, so-called Western Europe, the last 45, 50 years of just total assault on the working class is at a breaking point. I mean, you can see it on the streets in France and Germany and other places whenever they take another little piece of flesh out of the people. And the problem is, that even though the conditions are such that after all these years of austerity, all of this, the situation of precarity and worse that people face, there's no political consciousness. People have had that burned out of them over the last 40 or 50 years. And so if there's going to be anything that happens when the spark is lit, that's going to result in the people being able to take charge of their own fate, it's going to require elevating the level of political awareness of the people. And to me, the one single thing that could do that, that has a chance of doing that at all at this moment in the United States, would be a public dialogue between Trump and Kennedy. I don't know what else would reach that many people and create that much dissonance with the official narrative and reify people's understanding that they've been fed a load of crap for all these years. Yep. And to open their minds up and start looking for solutions.
No, you're right. And isn't that the one program that they don't? It's almost like I remember during the pandemic thinking, well, wouldn't it be good to have Bill Gates debating with Dr. Andrew Wakefield? You know, these are the people who I think, you know, anyone that's worked in, you know, mainstream mass media broadcasting, that is what you want. What you want is the most articulate people and the most extreme ends. Then what you get is a genuine debate. What we're getting is we're getting these tiny little, like, you know, fractions. If you imagine the color spectrum, it's like a little bit of red at one end from orange to red. And then you're getting a whole load of yellow, you know, a little bit of that part of the spectrum. But you're not getting the whole spectrum. You know, what you're doing is basically you've got journalism in black and white rather than in color, right, or, you know, whatever. But anyway, so finally, there's a lot of what Trump's saying, Don, is critical of China. It's critical of Hunter Biden. It's critical of Joe Biden and these various deals with the Chinese. So, I mean, this is something I imagine for you is a little bit awkward because, you know, what you're doing there is you're going over to China. You're looking at actually what China is much more reasonable than we're being told. But Trump is using this as a stick to beat Biden with. So how justified do you think it is?
Well, it's even, you know, I even have some further contradictions in particular with Trump, but also with Kennedy. And that is, first of all, the complete mischaracterization or bastardization or obfuscation of the terminology and just plain ignorance among the population of such terms as left and right. Trump talks about Biden as being an ultra leftist communist, he's a Soviet, you know, I mean, it's absolute nonsense, ahistoric nonsense. I understand what he's doing. When you have a population that's been brainwashed into thinking that evil and the enemy is communist, then you've got people feel like that guy looks pretty evil to me. You call him a communist and they go, oh, I get it. That is like a technique that, I don't know, I'm not going to impute his intent, but that's what I see going on. The problem, of course, is once you light that fire, you can't put it out. And I've been a communist, quote unquote, since I was 17, 18 years old. That's 50 some odd years ago. And the idea that Trump is going to set a mob off looking for people like me, thinking I'm responsible for Joe Biden getting his son a $5 million bribe from China. It's really a sloppy mess of...
Well, I mean, the same is true with RFK, isn't it, as well? Because, I mean, he's come out as very, very pro-Israeli state, for example, and right, anti-Palestinian. And he's had a go, for example, at our wonderful Pink Floyd writer and singer-songwriter, right, Roger Waters, which is, you know. So what's going on with RFK?
I won't impute intent to any of these people. I don't know what goes through their minds. I can only look at the landscape. All right, so if I'm Robert Kennedy, okay, and I see the big problem being, you know, we're sliding into a major war with Russia and China. We've got all these structural problems, economic and other political structural problems, and they all have to be dealt with. For me to do anything about it, I have to become president, or I have to at least be in the conversation enough to mobilize, you know, group a chunk of the masses to work on these problems. And in the United States, if you don't utter the Tourette's language about Israel, you're done, period. And so You know, my view of Israel is that it is a European settler colony, genocidal. Just, you know, look at the people, you know, they're trying to actualize the mythology of a land without people, without a people that they used when it was stolen and handed to Europeans, you know, over the course of the beginning and the middle of the 20th century. I don't think that the state of Israel, quote unquote, has a right to exist as a state of Israel. That doesn't mean I think the people that are there should be executed the way that this is treated in the media, like they said about the way Ahmadinejad spoke about it, because that's not what he meant either. But I think the state itself is illegitimate. That's Palestine.
Martin?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this is very difficult because we're often faced with choices which are not ideal choices. And you can see politics does require people to, Robert F. Kennedy is going to find it difficult to challenge the Israel lobby. He just is. And if the electoral system was different, if the constitution was different, then it wouldn't be. You know, in Europe, it was quite traditional in places like Austria and Switzerland for the left and the right to form coalition governments. So it was a different kind of culture. In the Anglosphere, it's winner take all and all the rest of it. And all of these things, and the people just not knowing enough of their own history to understand.
You've hit the nail on the head, I think, finally there, Martin, because I don't think it's so much about the electoral system. A lot of this is about the press and the media and the mass media and what kind of possibilities that they open up for people and how they frame the debates when it comes to elections, that sort of thing. I know I keep saying finally, Don, and I know you've got to go, but we've just had an announcement here about fossil fuels. Rishi Sunak's been up saying, well, we're going to open up a whole load of new oil and gas franchises up in the North Sea, plus we're going to start doing carbon capture. And of course, this is a bit awkward for the Labour Party, because once those oil concessions have been given out and the gas concessions, it's going to be impossible, really. Very, very difficult for an incoming Labour government to reverse that. So what do you make of this whole sort of oil, gas, carbon, zero carbon debate?
I've been watching around the U.S. media, the left or alternative or whatever. For example, Jimmy Dore in particular yesterday, pulling out some old Barack Obama clips. When you now have every Democrat of every stripe talking about the need to do away with fossil fuels by 3 o'clock this afternoon, on their way to large conferences in their private jets, and as the U.S. military has the largest carbon footprint in the history of this part of the galaxy, I think, Barack Obama boasting, however, about how they've drilled and produced more oil than any point in the country's history. This is only a few short years ago. Today it's popular. Tomorrow it's a weapon. I don't think that there's an honest conversation that can be had about any real public policy issue at this point in the Western media. As far as talking about electoral politics, for example, when I was growing up, they used to have mandatory class in elementary and secondary school in civics, where you studied the structural, like the U.S. Constitution, the government structures, just very fundamental, theoretical, and some, the classroom laboratory participation actions, so people would get a little conceptual grasp of how the world works. They did away with that when I was in high school, and I graduated in 1972. People here since that didn't get a political science degree in college, and many that did that I know, have no idea whatsoever how the law works, how government works, what political economy even is. And so those are the people that are confronted with all of the things we're looking at right now, and they're mystified, stupefied, really. And it's not anyone's fault except the people that designed the condition, who benefited from it, by the way. But that's what we're confronted with.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me we've got this whole kind of accelerationism everywhere now. this dark enlightenment where you've got we had obviously the pandemic, we've got the climate crisis, we've got the migrant crisis, we've got the economic crisis, and the solutions to all of these various crises, which have been vastly exaggerated and made, you know, is to make things worse. At some point in the future, these are all going to come together in some kind of conflagration, it seems to me. Anyway, what's the best way for people to follow your work, Don, and maybe to get hold of some of the reporting you've been doing in Europe and China?
Okay, my Facebook page, my name is spelled Don, D as in David, O, N as in Nancy, new word, DeBar, D as in David, E, B as in Bob, A, R. At Facebook, just look up Don DeBar. Most of my work I post there in my feed. Also at Don DeBar on Twitter. Also at VK.com, Don DeBar. Also,
yeah, good old VK. Yeah, excellent choice. Yeah,
I love VK. Yeah,
this is where Edward Snowden went when he went over to Russia, isn't it? Started working for them.
Yeah, it's great. Also on YouTube, Don DeBar, one word. YouTube.com/Don DeBar. Also, Rumble. YouTube censors me sometimes. Facebook suspends me once in a while. VK, I've never had a problem with. Twitter, I got suspended twice, but I haven't had a problem since Musk took over. You know, and I do work with Press TV and some other outlets, and you can see me there from time to time also.
Okay, Don DeBar from New York, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Tony, thank you, brother. Thanks everyone there. Thank you very much.
The Old Testament lesson is written in the 55th chapter of the book of the prophet Isaiah, in which the sacramental life of the church is prefigured. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and return not thither, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign which shall not be cut off. Here ends the first lesson.
We stand to sing the ancient hymn for the night office of Compline, Te Lucis Ante Terminum, before the ending of the day.
So that's from 1969, Jefferson Airplane there, with the Greasy Heart, the wonderful, unmistakable voice of Grace Slick. And before that, it was Forever Young by Alphaville, 1985. And before all that, you heard a bit of Choral Evensong from Wednesday, and the hymn was The Ending of the Day. The sort of thing, if you're in the ruins of an old monastery pre-Reformation, you can almost hear the monks singing that stuff. I'm not sure if it would have been English. It probably would have been in Latin. But anyway, you know, that's the kind of thing. It's very evocative, I think. And these beautiful old buildings around the country, absolutely horrific. What happened? The people must have thought back in the mid-1500s, they must have thought that was the end of the world. My God, all the monasteries being smashed up and broken down. That means our... a lot of the education was going, the libraries were going, brewery, some of the breweries were going, people, the road making was going, the tile making was going, and so much of course the infirmaries as well, the hospitals going. It's rather like a kind of, I suppose, it a Thatcherite type sell-off of everything that the state was putting together, everything the country had which was worth having, was just being flogged off. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I think we better start, Martin, with this report. If you don't mind, I'll just start by playing it on ITV this week. Really rather worrying that the United States Air Force is now about to start flying its drones out of Gloucestershire here.
American military drones are familiar weapons of war used for surveillance and military strikes. Never before have they been routinely launched from bases in Britain. That could be about to change. We have seen documents showing an application to the Civil Aviation Authority to fly US Air Force drones from RAF Fairford in the Cotswolds.
The unmanned eyes in the sky. Drones have been a part of the military aerial arsenal for years, but not from British soil. Now our skies are set to host these aircraft. The US Air Force want to routinely use them from their base in the Cotswolds.
Find the unfindable. Discover the undiscoverable. This is what we do.
The Americans are keeping tight-lipped about their plans, but documents submitted by the MOD to the Civil Aviation Authority and seen by ITV News shed light on their intentions. They say there is an emerging requirement to operate regularly from RAF Fairford, and that in a congested and complex airspace, they will not have the required detect and avoid capability to spot other aircraft. The airspace at RAF Fairford routinely plays host to B-52 bombers. Cold War aircraft, mechanical relics compared to the drones that are coming, and for which the Civil Aviation Authority have been asked to free up airspace for unmanned flights.
The underlying technology that to allow this is far from mature, and drones crash an awful lot.
Campaigner and researcher Chris Cole monitors the use of military drones. He argues that practically and politically the use of drones here needs to be considered carefully.
Drones are normalising warfare, making warfare much more likely, and that's why we really need to think about and be very clear that the US must not be allowed to use drones from RAF Fairford. Drones have been used outside of armed conflicts more and more to undertake so-called targeted killings, and those killings are undermining global peace and security.
Getting them airborne requires dedicated airspace. If approved, they'll take off and land only after sunset and before sunrise, using an air corridor passing through lower altitudes used by light aircraft before heading above commercial aircraft height of 30,000 feet towards their cruising altitude of 60,000 feet, where they can stay for more than a day.
UAVs have tended to replace manned aircraft in what's called the dull, dirty, and dangerous missions, and reconnaissance generally is a pretty dull mission.
Boring, perhaps, but experts say a drone's information-gathering capabilities are crucial.
Britain provides a great geographical base from which to spy on people. It's a great place to base an aircraft because it's a relatively short flight from Britain into the operating areas, which are generally off the coast of Russia or Kaliningrad these days.
The US Air Force told ITV News that due to operational security, we cannot discuss future plans for assets and missions operating in the RAF Fairford airspace. However, they added that they are taking prudent steps to ensure we will have freedom to manoeuvre should the need arise. For Britain and the US, there is, whatever the fears, a benefit of basing drones here, and in so doing, ensuring that eyes are always on the enemy. Rupert Evelyn, News at 10.
Big ITV report, hardly covered anywhere else, Martin, but this is enormous, really, it seems to me, as a story. I mean, we know all about the Americans' double-tap drone strikes. I think, as far as I know, the drones were already based in Germany, but not here so far. The obvious question here is, when they're talking about, attacking Kaliningrad, but then they're also saying, the Americans are also saying that they reserve the right to attack other places, presumably elsewhere in Europe, maybe France, Germany, Norway, Denmark, or even here in Britain, if they so choose.
Well, it's a continuation of the subservience of British policy to US geopolitical goals, isn't it? I mean, we really are at airstrip one, and this is just a continuation of that. The real danger is, of course, that we're going to trigger a war with Russia, and the Russians will retaliate on British soil.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think the real danger here is that these drones are going to be used against dissidents, NATO dissidents in the NATO countries and in Europe. There may be, because what we've been getting quite a lot is these. Let's just go back to the Iraq War. Around about a year or so after Paul Bremer and the Americans took over Iraq, with no elections, just put this guy in charge. They still had a weekly newspaper, the Al Sadr newspaper, and not long after the American administration took over that country, there was reports went all around the world. I remember it like it was yesterday. Of a suicide bomber blowing up in Baghdad, blowing up a bus queue full of people. So something like 20 were killed. There's a whole load of people's bits of bodies lying on the by the side of the road. And this news went all the way around the world. It's got shock and horror over 24 hours, and it's all forgotten. But the Al Sadr newspaper published at the end of that week that eyewitnesses said it was actually a missile fired from a helicopter that had caused the explosion. So you don't need to have lots of imagination to think that, well, maybe these drones are actually going to be firing weapons that are then, are supposed to be some sort of maybe a suicide bomber, maybe a gas explosion, maybe a terrible accident with a petrol bowser or anything. Any kind of massive explosion and death and loss of life could be actually these US drones causing it.
Well, it could. I think it's more likely to be in North Africa and rather than in Western Europe that they'll be doing these things. I mean, we've got no control.
But don't you think that the the focus has been basically the US expansion in the Middle East and Europe seems to be being blocked by the Russians. And so now they're looking at their own domestic population as one of the most serious problems because, domestic dissent in the Western countries is becoming a more and more serious concern, isn't it?
It is, but I don't think the drones are necessarily the answer to domestic dissent. They've got other mechanisms for dealing with domestic dissent, haven't they? It's just another nail in the coffin of British independence.
And what about this? What about this whole idea that the drones are actually taking over now? Because autonomous drones, as our sound engineer Dave was pointing out, are being flown by AI. We've got the evidence that the Palantir program, Alex Karp, the Bilderbergers Palantir program, is being used now to do targeting of Russians in Ukraine with no human beings involved whatsoever. So a drone may even be just a computer orders it to take off on a computer-designated target.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, we're already, whether we're using AI or not using AI, going out of our way to attack Russian infrastructure and kill Russian military personnel. The Russians, for their own reasons, are showing restraint in response to this. But, of course, if fools in Britain really want to have a war with Russia, we might end up getting our wish. And we're much more, in actual fact, it doesn't make much difference because the Russian capability in missiles now is great enough that they can actually hit the United States of America within 30 minutes.
Well, they don't need to do that if they can just blow up RAF Fairford, do they?
Yeah, well, what may happen if the Russians get provoked enough, they may just decide that they're going to put in a load of Kinzhal strikes on military infrastructure in Britain. And that would involve killing lots of US military personnel inside Fairford, for example, and then daring the West to do something about it. Because if they try to fire back at military bases in Russia, those drones will be shot down. Because the Russians have got overwhelming superiority in this technology.
Well, hang on, you're saying that, but there have been drone strikes in the Russian capital.
Yes, but that's been carried out by sabotage squads based inside Moscow. And, of course, Fairford itself is open to attack. When we went and protested there in the 80s, I just happened to notice that virtually everything is up by the fence. An old-fashioned IRA bunker buster bomb could destroy everybody building that drone or servicing it. So, you know, you can do that. You can blow things up in Russia by using commando techniques. Well, they can do the same thing to you, can't they?
Yeah, they certainly can. What do you... I mean, this is just looking at the sort of UK-US relationship, as we're doing with that story from ITV there, it is... We've had news, haven't we, over the last couple of weeks, and, you know, it's because we've had a couple of weeks with shows, once where I was out in the middle of nowhere, where I was finding it rather difficult to keep track of what was going on. In fact, we even, 2 weeks ago, our programme, we didn't even talk about the, I'm sad to say, although I think you were trying to hint at getting it discussed, Martin, was the by-election results, which have been not as good as they should have been, really, for the Labour Party, certainly not in Uxbridge in London. But the reason I wanted to talk about that is because of the revelations, I think it was either the Grey Zone or Declassified, those two excellent, I mean, these are the replacements, really, for the old legacy media, showing that Keir Starmer has shredded all the records of his trips over to the United States to the Justice Department during the Swedish... it wasn't a trial. There weren't even charges. But the Swedish legal debacle with Julian Assange. So he's actually, what he's doing is he's perverting the course of justice. Here is a public prosecutor when he was director of public prosecutions, actually making sure that there's no paper trail for the corruption that he was going over to the United States and doing what the Americans wanted him to put Julian Assange in prison.
Well, as I said earlier in the programme, Keir Starmer is the candidate for NATO to run this country. He's flagged this up. I mean, he goes out of his way to say how subservient he is to US policy. So that's in a way, it's out in the open and up front, isn't it? There's no ambiguity about it. But, of course, I think British special forces were probably involved with the SBU in the assassination of Zakarchenko as the elected prime minister of the Donetsk Republic in 2017. And clearly, Britain regards it's okay to kill other people's elected prime ministers, even when there's a ceasefire in place. Now, that should make him think, because, of course, two Tory prime ministers, John Major and Margaret Thatcher, were nearly killed by the Provisional IRA. Now, ultimately, if you're going to say it's fair game for other people's prime ministers, you better watch your own back, haven't you?
You had. And Keir Starmer also joined the CIA-linked group, the Trilateral Commission, while serving in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. Starmer served on the Trilateral Commission alongside two former heads of the CIA without telling Jeremy Corbyn, who would have blocked it, Declassify can reveal. Another story relating to Starmer's treachery, really. I mean, it sounds like we've got a kind of Saruman character. And I'm not saying the Tories are any better, Martin, but really it's such a pity that there isn't any real opposition when this CIA organisation founded by David Rockefeller, which has got these old CIA bosses in it, the Trilateral Commission, Starmer was on a bound to declare that when he joined it, and he just didn't tell anyone about it. He was secretly, sneakily going along to these Trilateral Commission meetings, very much like a sort of wider Bilderberg conference. So you've got David Lammy, the Bilderberger, is going to be our Foreign Secretary, and our new Prime Minister is going to be a Trilateral Commission man, both of them basically embedded within the CIA and selling out the entire country, a couple of total traitors. So what do you make of that, this Trilateral Commission and organisations like this, which have been set up by big business, in this case, the Rockefeller oil and banking dynasty, to groom and to program our future politicians?
Well, it's in plain sight, isn't it?
I mean, well, there's not been a lot of reporting about this. No, it's not in plain sight. I mean, this is on declassified.
Like us. Yeah. Other people, of course, you know, their minds are filled with all sorts of things, you know, women's football contests and all things that are going on out there. Starmer is what he is. He's a pro-establishment Labour candidate, and the Labour Party itself has always been a vehicle for, the powerful to try and control.
For the Americans and for the city of London, yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's always been like that, and it still is.
Well, the Labour Party hasn't, has it?
Well, it's gone through various phases. There have been struggles within the Labour Party and within the trade union movement to try and steer the policy in certain directions, and we all know where that ended up.
I mean, I know, for example, you and I quite often sort of tussle over this idea of electoral politics and the press, and I'm just going to sort of bowl one to you right now, Martin, which is Tucker Carlson, who was booted off of Fox News for reasons which, I would say probably a non-disclosure agreement when this Dominion voting court case that was meant that Rupert Murdoch had to sack him and get rid of him, or else the Dominion would pursue the court case against Fox and against the Murdoch empire, which they may well win, and Rupert Murdoch will lose maybe a half or three quarters of his assets in the press. So of course he can't do that. So I think that's the reason why Tucker Carlson was given the heave-ho, because he was also pulling in less advertising revenue, because the big corporate advertisers didn't want to advertise on his program, even though he was pulling in far more viewers than anybody else. So it just shows you this whole corporate media thing. Actually, the model doesn't work. It's perverse. But anyway, here's Tucker Carlson, because he's doing his show on YouTube and getting millions of hits on there, where he explains what's been going on at Fox News, where one of the producers there decided he wanted to have a bit of a pop at Joe Biden, and he got the heave-ho as a result.
Yes, Donald Trump is a flawed man, but his sins are minor compared to those of his persecutors. In this life, we don't get to choose our martyrs. We can only choose our principles. Hey, it's Tucker Carlson. On Tuesday afternoon, the Biden administration had Donald Trump arrested. It was a pretty big news story. You may have seen it. Just before 9 p.m. that night, as part of its coverage, Fox News ran two live video feeds next to one another. On the right, Donald Trump addressed his supporters in New Jersey. On the left, Joe Biden spoke at an event for the Secretary General of NATO in Washington. Beneath those videos at the bottom of the screen, Fox's banner read this way, quote, "Wannabe dictator speaks at the White House after having his political rival arrested." Those words were up for less than 30 seconds, but the effect was immediate. Inside Fox, the women who run the network panicked. First, they scolded the producer who put the banner on the screen. Less than 24 hours after that, he resigned. He'd been at Fox for more than a decade. He was considered one of the most capable people in the building. He offered to stay for the customary 2 weeks, but Fox told him to clear out his desk and leave immediately. Then the company issued a public apology for the 27-second-long wannabe dictator line. Quote, "The Chyron was taken down immediately," Fox's PR department said, and then added ominously, it was, quote, "addressed." That was all true. But it was not enough to save Fox News from the ensuing scandal. For a time in the rest of the media, Fox's assessment of Donald Trump's arrest seemed to overshadow Trump's arrest itself. Suggesting that Biden is a dictator, declared the Washington Post, quote, "crossed the line." Alexander Vindman agreed strongly. Vindman is the perennial MSNBC guest and full-time Ukraine promoter you may remember from Russiagate. On Twitter, he demanded that the Pentagon pull Fox News from all military bases. It is, quote, "absolutely unacceptable for American Forces Network to carry programming that directly, spuriously, attacks the commander-in-chief of American Armed Forces," Vindman wrote. In other words, Joe Biden must ban all criticism of himself because that's what non-dictators do. John Cusack went further still. "For the crime of calling Biden a dictator, Fox should be shut down," wrote the 80s-era movie star. Quote, "the government has to take away their broadcasting license."
So for calling, I'm a journalist calling Biden a wannabe dictator for trying to put his rival in prison, this guy is sacked. I mean, I think it's very illustrative of the importance that the mass media has, Martin, in trying to shape opinion. And also the basically immediate, you know, some guy who's apparently a very good producer, we don't know for sure how good a producer he is shot in the head, effectively, in the terms of the psychological warfare game.
Well, I mean, there is no rule. There's no rules in this arena, is there? Anybody can say what they like, and then, of course, the other people will then take steps to get you sacked if they don't like what you've said.
It's all about power, isn't it? But what I'm trying to say here is the extent to which the press is, you know, the journalists are not free to say what they want to say, and the press is, and the owners of the press and the managers of the press are shaping the entire narrative of what we're allowed to think or not think.
Well, of course. That's what's been going. I mean, obviously, it's intensified as the economic and social and political crisis has intensified. This attempt to control narrative has become absolutely obsessive on the part of all sorts of different people. And, we're doing this for nothing on the internet. And meanwhile, Fox News has a massive budget to say what it wants, and who can stop them? Unless they, you know, Murdoch is ultimately the boss there. He decides what can and can't be said. And we could have rules about it, but we don't have any rules about it. There are supposed rules around things like the BBC, because it's publicly funded, and therefore they're supposed to give everybody a fair crack of the whip. But things like Fox News or the Daily Mail or the Morning Star are under no obligation to give their opponents a fair crack of the whip.
Well, we did briefly look at Niger. I asked Don about it, and he did a fantastic look at the whole background to the colonial politics in Africa. But what do you make of what's been going on? President Biden has called today for the immediate release of Niger's president. The US has backed a threat from other West African nations. They would intervene if President Bazoum wasn't reinstated. The French are immediately all flown out, the French military that were based there. So is this a coup? It's almost like this looks to me as if it's the Russians saying, look, if you can play hardball in Ukraine and elsewhere, we can do the same in Africa. And actually, a lot of these African nations think that we are far more honest dealers than the Americans are.
Well, I don't think the Russians had a direct hand in the coup, because there have been several other coups in other countries.
Well, they're saying the Wagner Group may well have had a big hand in it. Of course, that's a bit like the Americans using Blackwater, Eric Prince's lot.
Yes, there's a relationship between Wagner and some of the other regimes in the Sahel. It's a very important area for various reasons. And, of course, a lot of the destabilization in this region was caused by, guess what, our intervention in Libya. Because we just opened the doors to all of this. Lots of weaponry was stolen from the Libyan armed forces and then ended up in the hands of various jihadis in West Africa, which then, of course, gives an excuse for the West to intervene to try and deal with the jihadis, which they've empowered by overthrowing Gaddafi. And, of course, what's really going on is an attempt to control resources and, basically neocolonialism of one kind and another, which is why these coups have been directed against the French. In Mali, they've just made French no longer the unofficial language of the country. And this is the struggle is going on across the planet. You know, Taiwan's turning into another bone of contention. All of the African countries, as you said earlier, are in St. Petersburg discussing, you know, strategy going forward with the Russians. So there's no boycott of Russia there, is there? South Africa, Nigeria, they're all represented in St. Petersburg. We don't talk to the Russians, but they do. And they don't see the war in Ukraine.
Well, most of the rest of the world do. And I think what amazes me is that most of the rest of the world, or the minority of the world, is now framed in the Western press as the international community says this. Well, actually, no, they don't. That's just a lie. Anyway, we're going to be looking a little bit at climate before we finish. And that's because of the announcement that I mentioned when we were chatting to Don by Rishi Sunak about allowing these new oil concessions and gas concessions, plus also giving the green light finally to this whole carbon capture project, which does sound interesting. We've been chatting to David Douglas about this over the last year or so, and from the National Union of Mine Workers is one of the people who's helped develop this and push it, this whole idea of carbon capture. And but before that, this is a story which is, I mean, it's just, in a way, going back a minute to Niger, Al Jazeera is doing the job. Much of this stuff, you will see the stories appearing and being reported on Al Jazeera for a day or 48 hours before they even make it onto the British. It's almost as if they're thinking, well, how are we going to spin this? How are we going to spin that in their news meetings? And then about 48 hours after they work out how they're going to lie to us about a particular story, will that story actually even make it to air? So let's have a listen to this one about the ship called, I believe, the Fremantle Highway, that's been burning away off the coast of Denmark and Holland.
Cargo freighter Fremantle Highway on Wednesday had been visible in the far horizon there just north of the island of Ameland. A plume of smoke rising from it is now drifting in a westerly direction with the currents and the winds. It's now just off the neighbouring Frisian island of Terschelling. It is under emergency tow only. That means they will only attempt to manoeuvre it if it drifts into international shipping lanes, which currently it is not doing. And really, beyond that, all they can do is wait and watch it burn and hope that this fire burns itself out so that the vessel can be safely salvaged. The big concern on these islands, though, ecologically sensitive as they are, is what happens if it sinks, disgorging its cargo of nearly 3,000 vehicles, as well as oil and fuel, into the sea to wash up on these beaches. Famous for their mud flats, their migratory birds, a huge array of species, land and sea. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. They've seen ecological damage before from shipping in these waters. They don't want to see it again, and potentially much worse this time. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera, on Ameland Island in the North Sea.
Yeah, well, the reason this hasn't been being reported as much as the Greek fires or the terrible British, apparently, climate change weather we're having during July is, of course, because it's the wrong story. The story here is that much of the, well, the cause of this is apparently an electric vehicle that caught fire amongst a load of other electric vehicles on this ship being shipped around. And it's now caused, $500 million worth of vehicles to burn up, and of course masses of pollution. The thing is, you do get the idea, Martin, that the technology isn't really quite there for these electric vehicles yet. If an electric vehicle fire can cause such absolute devastation, this ship has been towed into harbour. Is the latest news, apparently. The ship itself has been saved, but if you look at pictures of it, it's got great holes in the side where obviously very intense fires have burnt their way through the side of the ship, or at least whatever was, may not have been steel on the side, it may have been some sort of panelling or something. But it's in the northeast of the Netherlands now, 4,000 cars burnt up, and the whole cause of it is some spontaneous combustion, which seems to happen far too regularly with these EV electric vehicles.
Well, I didn't know it was an electric vehicle that caused the fire I was aware that there was a fire on a ship. The electric bikes caused a fire in Bristol not long ago. There's obviously an issue here that's, there are fire safety hazards involved with all electrical goods. I mean, there was an electrical fire that started the inferno at Grenfell. As you know, the decision about what stories to run and not run is based upon, the forces that we were discussing before we had the last clip.
Yeah.
So, everybody's trying to bend your ear in one direction or another, and the people with the loudest voices generally decide what goes in the news, don't they?
Yeah, well, at least 20 Indian sailors were rescued from the Fremantle Highway. I think from memory, week before last, when the story first happened, there was, I think, one of the sailors died, but they had to be taken off anyway. I mean, it just annoys me that something which makes it so obvious. We were talking about ship insurance relating to the Black Sea, Martin, weren't we, in the grain shipments. I mean, this is there's also stories there saying now it's going to become extremely expensive to insure ships which are carrying any electric vehicles around the world. If they are, I mean, this technology seems as if it's nowhere near ready to go, and yet we're being told it's the future. Anyway, let's have a listen now to David Douglas from the National Union of Mine Workers, talking about the new announcement this week about oil and gas concessions, and also what he thinks is a great bit of technology which can be used with coal-fired power stations too. They're apparently going to be using it with gas stations, this carbon capture program.
I'm Dave Douglas, an activist and former official of the National Union of Mine Workers, still active in the coal fields. The announcement this week, I take it you mean on the question of the new oil and gas wells. Well, I mean, it's a very welcome development. It's basic common sense, as far as I'm concerned, that we develop our own resources. I mean, I'm not totally in agreement with their particular options, because really the almost infinite fuel that we have is coal, whereas we have a very, very limited supply of gas. And continuing to generate 40% of our power from gas is a fool's errand, really, because what we should be doing is developing clean coal technology to burn coal cleanly in the power stations. The irony is that Sunak has announced two clean fossil fuel power stations which will burn natural gas without emissions. Now, there's an irony, because the actual plan, and the Daily Mail's got a whole big picture of it, is a plan that's been stolen from Hatfield Main Colliery in 1990. Richard Budge, who'd bought the mine, brought forward a futuristic plan to build a clean coal power station at the colliery. It would produce electric power using a hydrogenization process, which burned the coal but didn't allow any CO2 to escape into the atmosphere. The CO2 was then piped underground along the Humber into the oil wells in the North Sea off the Humber ports. The Europeans put a third of the money forward. Another third was put forward by private investment. And the government had promised match funding for the best carbon reduction scheme on offer at the time. And the European Union at that time called this particular plan the best carbon reduction scheme in the world, which of course it was. It would have produced the cheapest energy at something like £35 per megawatt hour, which was a third of the price of nuclear and more than less than a quarter of the price of offshore wind and onshore wind.
Well, let me stop you there, David, because this isn't going to be used with coal, is it? It's a different type of carbon capture. The one that Sunak has announced.
Well, I haven't got the ironic point. The ironic point is the government pulled the plug on that clean coal power station, which was to be called the Don Valley system and was to be based at Hatfield Main Colliery. They pulled the plug on that by refusing to put their third in. They're now proposing to build that self-same power station, to all intents and purposes, with the same carbon capture structure, sending the CO2 down the same pipes into the North Sea, only using natural gas. That's the irony.
So why shouldn't they?
Well, why didn't they do it in 1992? Save the coal industry, save all of those jobs. We have 1,000 years of coal at Hatfield. Rather than using the very scarce gas that we've got to generate power, when gas should be used for domestic and specialist industries. So if we had not been burning gas off in power stations up chimneys, we would have had enough domestic supply of gas for people to cook their dinners on and heat the boilers with for 1,000 years, but we've burned it off in huge tracts to the point where it's now really scarce. Let's be right. The Labour Party is not the Labour Party that people know it is. It's no longer a party of the working class. They're not particularly not interested in the industrial working class or post-industrial areas. It's now a party of middle-class liberals, social democrats, and they've been heavily infiltrated. The policymakers are heavily infiltrated by this. I mean, I hate using the word a woke agenda, but people know what I mean by that. By these middle-class individualist identity politic causes, including rather extreme versions of green politics. And they have, of course they have. Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion were our favorite pals of Miliband and had been of MacDonald before. MacDonald used to boast of how great Extinction Rebellion were. So yes, this is now their agenda. Their agenda is to carry on the attack on industrial workers and build some kind of a future based on this net zero model, which frankly will be absolutely, totally chaotic. It will rip the guts out of the economy and society at large, because society won't work like that. It simply will not work. The agenda, the hidden agenda is people have to stop driving their cars. It's not a matter of switching to electricity, to electric cars. People know electric cars are inefficient. They produce emissions and there isn't an infrastructure for them to work. They won't work. The point isn't to get you an electric car. The point is to stop you driving your car. And likewise, going on holidays and all of the 15-minute zones and all of those things are all part of this to close down your social, political, and individual liberties. It's a whole other agenda, which is quite terrifying. Now, people may well vote for them because they hate the Tories so much, but they need to wake up to what they're letting themselves into. But Starmer, insofar as you can believe him, has said he will not undo any licenses which have already been granted. Now, you can see why that would be, because if licenses have been granted, and oil companies and gas companies go ahead at massive expense to do drilling and set up the infrastructure and set up the extraction and all the rest of it, and then he pulls the plug, somebody will have to pay the price. It will be an absolutely massive penalty that they will have to pay through the courts. Now, in the case of the Whitehaven mine, that doesn't apply yet, because there's still an appeal going through, which will be heard in October. But if that license is granted in October, then that should apply the same. They won't be able to pull the plug on the mine in Whitehaven without absolutely, totally catastrophic costs if they're prepared to pay that. But the nonsense will still be there. They're going to stop, under Labour's urging, as well as their own policy, stop the production of steel in Britain. Labour talks about green steel. Green steel just means recycled steel. It's not primary steel. It's not capital steel. You won't be able to make wind turbines out of this green steel. You can make your bicycles or a wok or a frying pan out of it, but you can't make a high-tension bridge or a multi-storey block of flats. That steel, if it's not going to be produced here, will be produced in Europe. And if it's produced in Europe, it will need coal. Now, you can either get the coal from Whitehaven or you can bring it across from Appalachia from the other side of the world. Now, you know, last time I looked, Whitehaven's closer to Holland and Germany than Appalachia is. So there's a demand. There'll be a demand for that coal to make the steel, which, by the way, we will be importing instead of producing it here. And the final touch of irony is, of course, the emissions that we're not making in Britain, we'll be making in Europe instead. So our emissions will be made in Europe in order to import the steel here. And if people can't see how diabolically stupid that is, really, you know, it's time to give up.
So that's David Douglas with two S's, Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S. And you'll find him on Facebook. You also get his book. And I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, what he's saying is that much as Starmer and the Labour Party's policies, really fueled by Blair in the background and Mandelson, etc., much as they're saying this is terrible, we shouldn't be doing it, blah, 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 once these concessions are signed and they're operating, there's really nothing that an incoming Labour government can do to cancel these programmes, the carbon capture idea, possibly the Cumbria coal mine, and particularly these new concessions for oil and gas of the big oil companies.
Yeah, well, of course, it's foreign multinationals who control our gas and oil. I mean, obviously, in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, it's run by the Norwegian government. Rishi Sunak is deciding that he's going to attack the Labour Party for being too woke and too green. So this is, of course, none of this is going to save of any help whatsoever as we go into the crisis this winter. It's not, you know, none of these concessions are going to be functioning.
No,
by
it'll
then.
All be very expensive. All these fuel prices. Isn't that perfect for the shareholders? All those people that bought those shares in the energy companies, they won't be paying any energy bills anyway because they get their dividends. Anyway, well, look, we're going to wind up. We're going to wind up this week. By having a listen to it. Well, I mean, Patrizia Opulenza has got a bit of competition this week because I spoke to Des Kay. He runs this thing in southwest London called SaveTheWorldClub.org, which is a kind of warehouse recycling centre where people can come and for a donation get things which might just go to the dump. So people bring him things rather than taking them to the local rubbish tip, and he's got a whole warehouse full of stuff, which is actually really useful, which is all quite reasonably well sorted out. As he's told me, it's kind of a full-time job. But he is also a bit of a poet, too. So I hope you can stay with us until the end of this, Martin, and maybe comment on Des's idea at the Save the World Club in southwest London, and also on his poetry, too.
Pan, plan, scam, pandemic, creating the fear in bread and systemic. Statistics manipulated to distort morbidity, giving repeated lockdowns validity. Average numbers for the time of year, with COVID to increase the fear. Pushed us to believe all the lies and shame, then the miracle cure came into the frame. Safe and effective was lobbied around until victims were suddenly hitting the ground. Now the stats show an increase of those who are dying. But we're not being told this, just more of the lying. When three towers collapsed and 3,000 died, this clearly showed how they turned the tide. And many still believe the original text. Are we prepared to go along with whatever comes next? Will we mask up and medicate, just joining the queue, whilst our loved ones still die and we don't have a clue? To the cause and effect that reduces population, look at the stats of every nation. Is eugenics the elephant in the room? We need to find out the truth pretty soon, or we end up digging our very own tomb whilst the elite go jetting off up to the moon.
Well, Des Kay, thank you and welcome to the show. Great little poem there. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself for us?
Yes, I'm Des Kay. I'm over in southwest London, and I've always been concerned about the environment. I'm quite a active environmentalists, and my emphasis is really on reuse and repair. I've got a warehouse with a charity that I started over in 1985, and this warehouse takes things from people who would normally take it to the waste transfer station, and it would end up in landfill. So we've got this warehouse we call the circulatory to keep things moving around. And it's going very well and keeping me very busy.
Well, how on earth do you fit that in with being a poet and a children's entertainer? Because I understand you do that as well.
Yes, I do. I've got some shows, one of them which is called The Amazing Cycle-Powered Answer to Everything Machine. And it introduces my charity called the Save the World Club, and that keeps people empowered and gives them a sense of responsibility and feeling that they're part of an umbrella organisation rather than out there isolated or on their own trying to save the world. So it keeps me busy, and it's all pretty well full time, but it's great fun, and I do a lot of playing and enjoying my life.
So that's Des K there speaking to me earlier this week. He, like me, has been elbowed out of the Green Gathering, which is coming up soon, I believe. Maybe it's round about now, in fact, maybe even this weekend, over in Chepstow. I think it wasn't. That was when it was last time. But they got rid of him because he was criticising the original narrative of 9/11, which, I mean, everybody with any brain cells has been doing almost ever since it happened. But so the Green Party people that organised that have booted him out, as well as not liking me, because I was a little bit sceptical about the climate change faith. But anyway, Martin, what he's doing there is pretty good, isn't it? The idea is, rather than just take things to be recycled and crushed or whatever, burnt, or however the authorities decide, so you can actually just have a local warehouse that you take stuff to. It's a little bit like these kind of furniture, you know, the British Heart Foundation furniture places, where rather than just take stuff to the dump, if it's in reasonable condition, there's someone else that will have it. And I think, in a way, this is a growth industry in a country which is economically coming down to on its knees.
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know the detail of what he'd been doing. It sounds admirable. You know, reusing and recycling things properly is a key to, you know, reducing our general environmental footprint. So, yes, he sounds as if he's, I mean, obviously, if he's questioning 9/11, that's something that I and you question quite a lot.
I think, so, yeah, for many of us, this is the start of a lot of this, you know, in the 21st century was, look, this 9/11 thing's a load of nonsense. We're just being sold a pup. And, of course, there's other pups coming on the back of all of that. You know, the war on terror, the pandemic. There's all sorts of these things out there. The idea of having, you know, upping interest rates is going to help anybody. You know, all these things, the Ukraine war, the idea that we should just give loads of, or lend lots of money to a guy called Zelensky to kill Russians. You know, this sort of thing. Anyway, so time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to our guests in the first hour, Tony Groner and Tyler Overall. Their film, her film about Tyler, or with Tyler, is The Wicked and the Bad. And also, of course, thanks to Don DeBar but joining us from New York, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. And I would suggest also maybe another good Telegram channel is this one over in Leicestershire, the Leicestershire Tribe, for next weekend's gathering. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, our email addresses, etc. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join me for Not the BCFM Politics Show on talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.